edition of Film Grok from Film Grok Studios in beautiful downtown Studio City. My name is Serge Delpierre, and today we're going to be doing the seminal film from 1995, Heat. With me today, to my left,
Tim McMillan.
And to his left,
Curtis Nelson.
And to my right is someone brand new. Your name, sir?
Michael Smith.
Michael Smith.
How brand new are you? Were you just popped out of the womb?
Just born yesterday.
Oh. Wow. Welcome to the world. We have a very nice movie for you. So anyway, the cue point for this film is right after the Warner Brothers logo fades to black. Right on that frame, we have it frozen. So we'll give you about a minute to get that set up, and then we're going to get going because we have 170 minutes to go here. 2 hours, 50 minutes. So, Curtis, your first experience with Heat?
I actually saw it live in the theater when it came out. So, I mean, it was, of course, the what everybody else here probably heard about it as far as the marketing going up to it the first time, the two kings of acting will get together and actually have a scene together.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, that was the big marketing plan behind it, and I saw it then. So, loved it. You know, anytime, that's where I really probably became a huge fan of Michael Mann and kind of been disappointed ever since. But, I mean, I still love Michael Mann, but ever since then, I do like Michael Mann. But, you know, what can you say? I mean, the one thing you'll say about this movie that everybody loves is the gunfight. So, but
right.
That's going to come up. So, the bank robbery.
Oh, yeah. Michael?
My first experience was in the theater in 1995, and I'd been a Michael Mann fan since long before this, going back to, you know, Last of the Mohicans and Miami Vice and all that sort of stuff. So, you know, I was excited to see this movie, and I was not disappointed.
Tim?
I saw this for the first time less than a month ago. It's one that slipped by me somehow. I'd always heard about it. Always heard about it in whatever circles I was in. People were like, heat this, heat that. I never got around to seeing it. Glad I did. The only other work of Michael Mann's would be Last of the Mohicans, really, that I had seen. I was not a Miami Vice person while that was on. But during today's commentary, I would like to introduce the Heat drinking game. Because
fantastic.
There is one person here drinking.
It's just Surge. One scene. It's one no. scene. But that
oh,
one
you.
Scene will knock you on your butt if you turn it into a drinking game, I discovered. So,
you know, I almost brought a flask, but I wasn't sure if that was acceptable.
No, it's acceptable.
Anything's acceptable. It's okay. I just, you know, just had water. I see a Coors Light on the table. My experience, you know, I saw 95. I don't remember the first time I saw it. I just remember loving it. Maybe it was in the movies. Maybe it's on video. I don't know. Whatever it was. Just I saw it. It was like, this is great. I mean, it made me love Michael Mann. And exactly. It was just like, he's been trying to make up for it ever since.
Prepare.
I hope you have another. Yeah. Anyway, okay, so let's get going. We've got a long show for you. It's going to be fun. So on my mark, I'll go 3, 2, 1, play. So 3, 2, 1, play.
And that being said, I mean, I guess the one way to start it is what Michael brought up about Michael Mann, which is a lot of people don't know, or maybe they do, the fans of this show, will know that he did Miami Vice, the actual television show from the 80s with Don Johnson and, what's the other guy's name?
Philip Michael Hall?
I'm sure he gets it all the time.
Hall? But anyway. Philip Michael Baker?
Might be it, but either way. Shouldn't even have brought it up.
Horrible about
it. But
we have to solve this.
The point being is that he... He did Miami Vice, and actually, where I got to know Michael Mann, I misspoke earlier, was for anybody that's never seen a great heist movie, probably one of the first heist movies, and actually started the genre of the bulletproof vest trick that they always do in movies, was Michael Mann in the movie Thief. With James Caan.
That's right.
And it's a fantastic heist movie with Jim Belushi, one of his first leading big roles in a movie, and it's an absolute great film.
Oh, yeah.
So am I to understand Michael Mann directed Thief?
Yeah, that was his second film. His first film was The Keep.
Exactly.
Oh, see, I didn't know that.
Oh,
Thief
yeah.
was a huge critical success.
Oh, and it was gorgeous. Oh, I haven't seen that.
And it's a great movie.
Robert Prosky's in that.
Yes. Oh, and then who was the female lead in that? The famous...
Tuesday Weld.
Philip Michael Thomas. Sorry, I had to say that.
It's okay. A condition.
But...
The L.A. Metro.
That's Manhunter was another one from his early days.
That's right.
Yes.
That's right. And Tom Noonan was in Manhunter. He played Francis Dolarhyde in that. Mm-hmm. And he has a cameo in here.
Yes.
So, Michael, you're saying that you were into Michael Mann at what point? I mean, from Thief on?
You know, I didn't see Thief until probably a little later on. I've only seen that one once, but I was young. I was probably in my early teens when I got into Michael Mann, and just it was probably right around the time of Last of the Mohicans.
Okay.
I mean, I watched Miami Vice and that sort of thing, but I became aware of him, you know, right around the time of Last of the Mohicans, and then just started watching everything of his that came out and everything that he had done up until that point.
Gotcha.
Yeah. This, by the way, already beginning. The shot's great with the arrow. Just looking down. I love the lens what they use because they're using a wide enough lens where everything's kind of curved in these wide shots, which I really, really like.
I was very won over by the style of this film. It's beautifully presented and composed. And I to know that he wrote and directed this, mm-hmm. this epic film. It's what's the running time on this thing?
It's 1 hour 70 minutes.
Mm-hmm. I'm very impressed to write and direct this.
Now the interesting thing, of course, about this, most I don't know if everyone knows about this, but of course, if you look on YouTube any amount, you'll know that actually this was a TV movie before this was a feature film called L.A. Takedown. It was essentially the same story and some of the essentially the same key scenes, but not as well done. It was done in 1989 by Michael Mann.
Hmm. There you go.
And then he basically got the budget for it so you could actually make it live like it did here, and it was just blew it out. Another thing is, I'm really struck. I really love Robert De Niro's performance.
Absolutely.
In this film. I think I want to put this out there, but I think this is one of his best roles.
Absolutely. And it's because it's so understated that it doesn't go, you don't notice it as much as maybe some of his other performances, but there's some really wonderful moments in this of his, and the best moments of his are actually when he doesn't have any dialogue at all.
Oh, yeah.
And there's just a few moments where there's no dialogue at all that are just really amazing.
Well, even his introduction is just, he comes right into how he's introduced, comes into frame, who he is.
Well, that's what I like about when Michael Mann's on, and you see it a lot in this film, how on he is whenever Michael Mann's on, he really allows for the actors just to be in the environment, he holds the camera on him. He allows for those moments, whereas a lot of directors might cut away and not show the nuances of the character just in their faces without any dialogue, whereas Michael Mann holds on these. And like even that shot right there, when they cut away and he walks out of frame, there was like a two or three second pause before the cut even went in.
Just breathing room.
Yeah, just there.
But I will say, who shot this, Serge?
Dante Spinotti. I was noticing that when his name came up. He's absolutely my favorite cinematographer. And, as we'll see a bit later on, the way he renders night scenes is just amazing. And the blues and blacks that he uses. And
I've noticed he's shooting very tight. He likes to be very close here.
He's had some wider shots, but for some things he's gone in tight.
This whole lovemaking scene
has been in tight. Yeah,
now,
exactly.
Is Spinotti the one that Michael Mann kind of had the riff with whenever he switched to digital and he no longer used him? Or
I didn't follow that exactly. I know he did use him most recently on Public Enemies. I believe.
Okay.
Which was
digital. I didn't see that.
Well, he's shot nothing but digital since Collateral. I believe.
Well, Collateral was mostly that, but then for the nightclub scenes, he did shoot film.
Yeah, well, that's always going to be the case for the action sequences. They'll use a lot of, like for Miami Vice, he shot it mostly digital, but a lot of the action sequences, you're not going to get a good transfer without it being kind of jumpy and all over the place through digital. So
then,
a lot of the times,
why didn't he just shoot it on film?
Well, that's
the
argument. But,
Yeah.
I spoke to a tech that worked on all of Michael Mann's films. He's the guy that's, is it the Gemini he uses? I believe it's a Gemini he uses. I might be wrong.
The camera? For a while, what was it? He was using the, I can't remember the name.
Or is it the Viper?
The Viper, yes.
The Viper.
He was using the Viper for a while.
It was the Viper. But anyway, it was the Viper, and I was talking to the guy that worked on him, and they're, basically, let's put it this way. There are a lot of bugs they're always working out on those, and they're still working them out. So they're always running into problems. And,
right. I really like the setup of the film, actually, right now, because they show, like, everyone in their own, habitats they're showing the beginnings of the heist for the other guys, but everyone's, like, going through their life, and here you got Rachel Portman.
Rachel Portman!
There's a whole Rachel Portman thing that goes on. It's Natalie Portman.
A young Natalie Portman.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, very young Natalie Portman. Rachel Portman is a composer who I joke basically composes every single film. She's a wonderful composer.
She is.
Elliot Goldenthal. She is wonderful.
Elliot Goldenthal did the score for this.
Yeah.
He can do a lot of moody stuff. Yeah.
I will say this. When I first saw this, I really bought that she would be their daughter. She actually looks like the spawn of the two of them, possibly, and that's rare in film.
Well, no, but she's not. She's actually, not his daughter. She's
exactly. But she's her daughter.
And she's her daughter. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, I could buy it.
Oh, God. This dude, Kevin Gage, he plays Wayne Grove, which actually in L.A. Takedown, Wayne Grove was played by Xander Berkeley, who makes an appearance in this film.
Yeah, the great thing about this whole opening from the train sequence on is it really sets up the quiet sort of rhythms of the film.
I love how he just leaves.
Yeah, leaves the cup.
I always wondered, and walks away. What about the drink?
Yeah.
to this day, I wonder about that.
But it's a great character touch because this guy is such a, well, I'm going to say, such a fuck up. I mean, he basically messes everything up for everybody in this story. Just everything. He is, well, yeah.
Well, I mean, and that's one thing I like about Michael Mann is his casting choices. I mean, so much to nowadays with stunt casting and agents kind of controlling almost every actor within a certain age range, they kind of stick people into certain characters that shouldn't be in there. Whereas when this guy walks on camera, you immediately sense badness and douchebag. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, there's nothing going to go good out of this with this guy.
It's wonderful when the guy asks him right there when he says, stop talking.
Yeah.
And that guy's reaction to it. What's the one with the beard?
Gage.
What's his name? Gage.
Yeah.
His reaction to Kim being stifled is wonderful. Yeah. And it sets up everything you need to know about him and the dynamics, I think.
Yeah, but that's great casting.
But also the thing is that Wayne Grow he should be shutting up, and instead he's just like, he's an idiot.
Yeah. Right, exactly. Thing. He's not professional.
He is the douchebag.
But you sniff him out real quick.
There's a great shot coming up here when they get the truck ready. And let's go back to what this is. I mean, this is a version of noir. I mean, really, it is a cops and robbers thing. And it has that noirish feel.
Absolutely.
If you look at all your night shooting, which Mike was talking about,
look at this shot.
Loves how it's shot.
Look at this. Look at how he just goes back into the shadow, and it's in daytime, perfectly. Mm-hmm. And it's like he steps into the shadows, which actually reflects what happens later when he thinks they're being seen, and he steps back into the shadow into the corner too,
and
the hockey masks, of course, too. Yeah.
I will say that I'll take the noir feel of this film over Collateral any day.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I liked the vibe of this film much better for that.
Collateral was not one of my favorite films of Michael Mann by any means.
Mm-hmm. I like the first half of Collateral. Actually, I liked the first half of Collateral a lot.
I love the ensemble work in Heat because the cast, the characters, how they interlock, the thread, how it all comes together. The ensemble work in this movie is very entertaining.
Right, and of course, the action sequences too are amazing. This is incredible. It's awful, but it's incredible.
Well, I love Michael Mann for the practicality of the action sequences and the plausibility of things actually being done. Like, you actually could see possibly this all working out. I mean, it seems to make sense. Like, for instance, his action sequences in something like the Miami Vice during the whole trailer park scene whenever they actually when Jamie Foxx disarms a guy. It's all believable. So it's not something that's, you know, Will Smith jumping off a motorcycle and flying 100 yards and shooting three robots in the air and then doing a tuck and roll. And then he gets up and he goes, hey, didn't I tell you to go to bed? You know, I mean, it's nothing crazy like that where all this makes sense. And it's just, it's based in reality. And probably Michael Mann timed all this out and probably they all went out and did it and learned how.
Well, one of the things I love about Michael Mann, you talk about sort of the naturalism of some of his stuff, but what he does for me is that he really blends a stylized sense of things in a lot of ways in some of the melodrama and that sort of thing and naturalism at the same time. And it's very rare that you find anybody that can blend elements like that and have a film that actually works. Mm. And that's, you know, a really amazing thing that he seems to pull that off time and time again.
Mm. The points of view, the cutting, it's very cinematic. The points of view have been amazing in the sequence here of how you're cutting from one to the next in order to see the entire scene of what's going on. It's beautifully put together.
It's clear. You know where you are and what's going on.
He holds on him.
Oh,
and you
get
to see that even under that mask. And that's a thing about acting and that's a thing about directing that really kind of bumps me.
Well, he's got the ponytail, too. That's what distinguishes him.
It's kind of, but it's like, you didn't even have to have that. It's just like, you see that there's something up behind that mask just by the way they framed that, moved the camera, and held on him for just that extra second.
and that's Tom Sizemore. Of course, it's just it's a plant there. About it's like, and then he just pulls.
Yeah,
right,
you know,
on
this guy's
going
to get it right here, just by that shot alone. You know,
look at that.
That guy's about to go
and,
down.
Well, I mean, what they had to do, obviously, with the mask is they blacked out the eyes. On that particular one, they blacked out the eyes so that you can't see his eyes. All you see is the mask. See, there's no eyes.
Yeah.
There are no. All the other ones have eyes. His doesn't.
This poor guy.
But yeah. That's the thing is what Michael Mann shows in this, it's the realism as opposed to being a nice guy. Now he realizes that they're all good guys. They try to do the best thing they can, but they still they will make the right decision for the most part, which comes back to bite them in the end.
Well, right. I mean, right per their credo, but wrong for those three guys who are now dead.
Exactly. That's true. But they realize they have to do it. It sounds like it's strange and true, but...
Well... I mean, yeah, I mean, they're sticking like, this is what the mission is, but they're still, they're not only robbers, but they're murderers. And that, I mean, that's what essentially puts everything, the heat on them, so to speak, you know. But I mean, in terms of planning it all out, it's all beautifully well planned out, and every aspect of it is thought through. And I think that's part of the appeal of this, is that they're, you know, it's like the crew that really knows what they're doing and how to handle it, and it's all professionally handled and everything.
And for anybody else that's ever going to have a bank heist or do a big, giant holdup, just don't bring in the new guy that some guy recommended that you know. That's the first rule. Only work with people you know. Mike, I'm looking at you.
I agree.
I'm looking at you, Mike.
Yeah, I know.
I'm looking at you.
There's some concern there, isn't there?
I don't know you yet. Just kidding. But never goes good.
I promise to do my best not to strangle any hookers during the course of this event.
Use a bit of control.
This is great lighting. How do they do that?
It's a nice shot.
Night scene.
That, I'd say, is...
an end-of-the-day shot, I would imagine.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
No blue screen, green screen there. That's
a
nice shot.
Actually, I think there's only one scene that has blue green screen, and that's...
The night scene between De Niro and that girl.
Yeah.
And you can kind of tell.
It's antiquated in the technology. Yeah,
it still looks nice. It, you know, it's a beautiful shot. It's just... it draws attention to itself.
It's, older technology being used to achieve it.
Yeah. It'd be great if you went back in and fixed it.
Ah, my question is:
who is he, George Lucas?
These age spots real on Voight, or they just didn't make them out, or did they put them on?
I don't know.
Let me tell you this: I sat through this movie the first time, and this now Voight's easily recognizable.
Yeah, but when you first saw
it. But when I first saw this, it was sort of, I guess, at a point when he was sort of, his face was changing, and I did not recognize him at all. I don't even think until either the end of the movie or until the second time I saw this movie.
Really?
That's John Voight. Because his face sort of had changed so much since the last movie I'd seen him in.
Oh, it's such a different look, but it's such a great... I mean, the great thing about this is there's so many great character parts. And actually, one really interesting thing is you have, and that's coming up soon, is the whole thing with Val Kilmer and his wife.
Mm-hmm.
When you have Val Kilmer and Ashley Judd, I mean, who at the time, they were, you know, they were headlining films. And here they took these supporting roles in this film. It shows the breadth.
Ashley Judd?
Ashley Judd plays...
She's 95 in this?
Yeah, 95.
In 95, she was...
She was one of the first like Double Jeopardy and all those things.
So here we have Al Pacino, and I love the foil quality of Al Pacino to De Niro. De Niro's really calm, cool, collected, and De Niro just cartoonish, loud, over the top, and like most of his scenes here, he just sort of always loud and noisy as opposed to De Niro just so quiet and calm and collected.
Yeah. Yeah, he's right, and he works that gum during this movie, doesn't he?
Yes.
Oh, and the fingers.
And look at this. Look at this. It's great how he has the shot set up, and you see the whole team.
Here he's going to break out the fingers for the first of many times here in just a moment.
That could be a drinking game.
Yeah, the Pacino punches in this movie are funny when he just punches a line of dialogue out of the middle of nowhere.
And
That's Ted Levine right there. Ted Levine played Buffalo Bill in Silence of the Lambs.
Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah.
And again, Michael Mann shot Manhunter, which was the original first of the book.
Yeah.
First of that series.
That's right.
Oh. Well, and he also has a callback with having Wes Studi in this from
Last of the Mohicans. Well, actually, going back to the guy with the TV, it's the whole thing with him knowing the thing about Slick. Because the guy said he called the other guy Slick, and that's what leads them eventually to figure out who they are.
Now, what Michael...
Ted Levine was another guy who looks dramatically different than, say, his performance in Silence of the Lambs.
Which is right around this time, too.
Yeah.
This was 95.
A
when
couple
was
years
Silence of the Lambs?
92, I think, was yeah. the year was they like, won the Oscars.
Yeah, like what, 2 or 3 years later.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a completely different role for
yeah.
him.
You wouldn't even recognize that that's the same guy that tucked his penis between his legs.
And what's the actor's name that was in Forrest Gump standing over Al Pacino's right
Michael
shoulder?
T. Williams.
Yeah, Michael T. Williams. Obviously, it's harder to recognize him because he had a big poached out lip from a prosthetic in Forrest Gump.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
What I actually like about this, I mean, what this film actually did to, oh, I love those shots with those lenses, man. But that, you know, here they have the whole thing of him breaking down the whole crime and being able to intuit it. Because they did the same thing with in Manhunter with William Peterson being able to just basically intuit the whole thing. Oh, what did he do?
He snapped.
Oh, damn, okay. I need a beer.
I love all the location work in this movie.
Oh, the locations in this are great.
Let alone the big gun sequence after the bank. I mean, that location is phenomenal. But all this stuff right here, under the freeway, and beautiful location stuff.
Yep. I mean, you've got this great scene where he lays out his relationship with everyone and how they're all part of his team, essentially. There's the blonde dude who I have no idea who he is.
Hmm. Looks like Sam J. Jones from Flash Gordon. But it's not.
It's not Sam J. Jones.
Danke.
Is it Sam J. Jones or just Sam Jones?
I think it was a J. I didn't keep track of that.
In this film, is Pacino. Oh, there he is, Winker, you fucker. But Pacino, basically, they head up a unit that handles multiple murders. Is that what it is?
I didn't hear. Michael, do you remember?
Oh, it's some sort of homicide unit. Yeah, I can't remember exactly what.
Now, with the actor Gage again, the guy that plays Wangro, if you want to see a really, I have to just say, if you want to see a fucked up movie, it's a movie called Chaos. It's probably really hard to find. I went and saw like the premiere of it.
Yeah.
And it's just it's a wackadoo movie, and he plays the lead in it. But, whew. Crazy movie.
I love that move that Sizemore just did. He steps out, and then he comes back in, and then he comes back.
Yeah.
Sizemore, I got to tell you, I mean, they're all really cool in this film. And for bad guys, really cool.
Just slams it. But,
and I love, look at this move. Sizemore just looks like,
yeah.
What are you looking at? And that little bit, you know, but they even cast for that. It's just little touches.
I mean, just look at this table alone of actors. I mean, Val Kilmer, Sizemore, De Niro, and even Gage. They're all really good actors, and I would imagine... Well, I mean, we know Sizemore's screwed up. We know Val Kilmer's always in trouble in New Mexico. And De Niro, I mean, he's got his own little foibles he enjoys. So, I mean, the point being is can we now assess that actors are a little bit off and we shouldn't have these sweet, lovable kids acting nowadays that we always get around and...
Wait, are you trying to tell us? Because I know you're an actor, right?
Yes,
Curtis. So you're trying
to
tell.
Oh. It just. Well, I mean, it,
so
just
being
as
an
a,
actor gives you license.
It doesn't
to be...
even say. It doesn't even say that as me being jealous. As a movie fanatic, some of the vanilla we get with acting today, it really bumps me.
Now this scene is cool is because you know that okay they're going to take care of Wangro. Now here that said, and they have to cool it. Okay, so the cops come. All right. Okay, nice shot. Actually, I like how the police car is lit from within, so you can see the cops. These little touches.
They shouldn't have turned away.
Well, okay. They turned away and the bad guy gets away. I mean, come on. I have just one quibble. I have two quibbles. This is the one of the two quibbles of the film.
Yeah. Plot device.
I know. But still. I can still be unhappy with it.
Yeah. No,
but
no.
It does allow us to have the rest of the film, though. Because if Wangro had died, the film would have been
sure,
over.
And of course. You got to let it go.
All right.
I have a percentage.
I don't mean you. I mean as an audience.
Well, I mean, but this is an interesting thing. Then, I don't know. Could it have been set up better?
I have a percentage where those things are concerned. If a film is so entertaining and so well presented otherwise, I have a suspension of disbelief that I'm along for the ride and I enjoy it.
Okay.
Here's where I love Dante Spinotti right
Very
here.
Very cool shot
right
in the beach house.
It's
awesome.
A lot of blue.
This is great mood setting. Look at that. I mean, it's a picture. It's a painting. It's Edward Hopper-esque in a way. Modern Hopper.
A little light on his head, the collar. Nice.
Is that sunrise? I mean, just before sunrise?
A little rack focus happening.
And look, I mean, the waves.
Beautiful.
That's where we hear the Jaws theme. Now, seriously, what time of day do you think this was shot? Just pre-dawn?
I think that was heavily filtered.
That was probably day for night would be my guess, the way you see the ocean. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to see
that
the ocean.
That much detail.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. There they are.
Yeah, actually, Judd was big by this time, right?
I didn't think so.
No, well, no, she hadn't done, I don't she think had, she's done their din, her din,
she hadn't done her, like her double Jeopardy and all those things.
I thought this was more of an emerging performance.
Okay,
rather than
well, then I'll buy it.
No,
post arrival,
she's still hot. Very hot. But Val Kilmer had been doing big things. He'd done The Doors.
Oh, yeah.
He'd done Tombstone.
Done everything the first time.
Yeah.
This was the same year as the Ghost in the Darkness.
Okay.
Probably the start of the downfall of him as far as that goes.
Well, it's a kind of a changing period for a lot of people. Because, even look at De Niro and Pacino. Mm-hmm. And I think after about this film is a lot of their films, they sort of became caricatures of themselves in a lot of ways in the films that followed. Mm-hmm. You know, De Niro and his loud talking and just sort of larger than life. It just became the same sort of routine over and over.
De Niro or Pacino?
Nice tracking shot.
Even De Niro, his roles became sort of thinner in a way in that... he went more towards the comedy and just not the same sort of potency, I think, after this.
Actually, I want to go back to that cut right there where we saw basically Val Kilmer shirtless peel out and then drive, and then we cut to Pacino in the car. It's a neat little trick because you expect to see Kilmer, and
right,
then you see Al Pacino, and then you're already into the other part of the story. And I also want to comment on his cell phone. Oh, my God.
95, baby. High tech.
Oh, wait till they start breaking out the pagers. And
But the pagers, actually, it works really well in this film.
Oh, no, the pagers are fine. It reminds you of the time period. This is sort of the end of that whole pager.
And at least the hairstyles are not that bad in this film. You go like, oh, my God, it's the mid-90s.
You want cell phones? The one that cracks me up the most, my best friend's wedding. Julia Roberts, you look at the end of that movie, it's like an army radio phone she pulls out of her purse to talk to, I forget the guy's name.
Okay, you waited how long to see Heat, and you've actually seen My Best Friend's Wedding. You're lucky my elbow is on the table.
You have to say that. They're both basically the same movie, aren't they?
I want to talk about the television, actually, for a second. Look at this. Exactly. We're into noir again.
But look at the picture behind, just at the same shot.
And now look at the TV. Now notice in these shots that he's sitting at the table. He's he's at the table with the TV. And if you look at the TV, you can see his reflection in these scenes because it's one of the few scenes that play in the house between them. And of course, the TV plays later in terms of their developing relationship. But if watch when you go to the TV, there you can see him right in there.
Yeah, he's in
every
the TV,
time. It's like it's him and the TV.
Exactly.
I like the key light on her face.
I like how he heckles the chicken.
We've all done that at one time or another. But right there, see the picture behind her? Mm-hmm. It's the same as the lighting across her face.
Oh, okay. Oh, wow. I never noticed that.
It's little things like that that makes such great cinematography. Now, what's some of Spinotti's most famous?
I know mostly for the Michael Mann stuff. I mean, from Last of the Mohicans.
He got nominated for that one, or did he win?
Which one did he get nominated? Oh, God. I can't remember off the top of my head which one he got. Somebody bring up IMDb. And basically, Manhunter and a lot of Michael Mann stuff.
I think he did do Collateral. Did he do Collateral?
I think that's the one that I might be totally wrong and even for saying, but I think that's the one where he kind of left like a little bit ways through it.
Someone left and then someone else took over.
And then
now
took over.
I'm remembering this a little bit, yeah.
Yeah.
Great diner. I mean, I got to tell you, having worked AD work, I mean, this place was set up awesome. Mm-hmm. I mean, just the way it is all plays so real. He's got some great ADs.
Exactly.
And for those who don't know about how films are made, basically the assistant directors are basically in charge of all the background, and they work with organizing them and placing them and organizing any action. So everyone you see there, I mean, there must be like at least 100, 150 people in there. You've got the customers, you've got the people behind there. They all have their thing.
And that's all the ADs doing their work. And well, which I'm sure Michael Mann actually has a big hand in that, too. But
in your establishing shot, there was. And this stuff, they have pared that down considerably for the amount of people.
Yeah, here.
Even
they,
still, but look at all
here
the
you,
night.
Here you have 25 people.
You have great activity in the background.
Yeah, it's the crosses. The thing I'm always impressed with ADs is when you get the nice crosses of the people moving back and forth, and it's nice and clean and works well in a shot.
Yeah, it all makes it look natural, and it's not meant to be noticed, but it's meant to blend naturally. And the and essentially, all the
he just disappeared. The guy that was crossing the to just
don't oh, make Tim notice these things.
I'm looking at continuity now of background.
Well, one thing I like about the casting of her, I forget her name,
Amy Brenneman.
Yeah, she's great, but just an everyday woman. You know, it's like that's another thing that the modern day casting would have this just drop dead Megan Fox or somebody throw them in there, and it's like.
And she'd come off of NYPD Blue, where she was on there for like I think the first season, and then she split. Mm-hmm. Back in the David Caruso, the whole David Caruso first season also, and she was really good in that. And I think she had another role. Maybe this was the next thing she did. And I think from there she went back to TV doing Judging Amy.
I really like that shot where it tracked and you went across the line of people sitting there, and then he shook her hand. Mm-hmm. You went from behind to in front. It was very. I like that.
Well, it's a great. Nice. It's a great way to
introduce that they connect
to transition the scene to the next part, and also to be able to. I mean, with the move allows you to then cut the other way across the line.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's a good director.
He knows. What's he been doing lately? Then
he knows what he's doing. Public Enemies.
Oh, that was what? How long ago?
That was like last year.
Okay.
I have not seen that one yet. I
haven't seen it either.
I haven't either.
You know, it's a digital thing. I'm like, I don't know. I like film. I like the way film looks. It looks really good. And Collateral did not bowl me over in how it looked. I like the feel of a lot of it. But I just, you know, I don't know. I'm sure the technology is getting better. I know. It could be arguments, but.
Yeah, I know aesthetically what appeals to me, and that's. Old school film and being cut that way in post and right to the very end. That's what I like.
Yeah. And this is really nice here because here he is. He's actually slowing down and actually having a human relationship that's outside of really kind of the atrocious work that he does.
Here's the sequence of the bad blue screen or green screen, whatever they're using at that time.
So it's here, right? This shot?
Yes.
Yep.
This is not
you can tell the
real.
The tracking. Is, yeah, the tracking's just a little off.
This whole sequence.
Oh wow! But it's a tracking shot.
Still works for me. I like
the living room here is green screened also. Just in case
but when they go to the close up to their faces, that's where it points it up that it's not a location work.
Yeah. The music's good
right there.
Yeah. There you go.
Now, I think it was Michael Mann that I heard that he actually stole some of the same ideas he had for this or used in this for Collateral. For instance, De Niro's always in gray. He's always really kind of polished, and he kind of threw that into the Tom Cruise character in Collateral. And so they're always dressed in gray. They're always polished and neat, but they're always in gray, so they just kind of blend into a crowd. So they just kind of blend into the background as opposed to standing out and being all gaudy and... You know, so they're not downtrodden, but they're also not so upscale that it's just going to bring them out.
Yeah, the wardrobe in this is great too, with the grays and blacks and all that sort of thing. So yeah,
I mean they have
all the muted colors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they have personalities. You know, they stick out. Yeah, you can. I mean, you can tell here. It still looks nice. It's a pretty shot of LA.
Yeah, I still love this scene with the sea of lights surrounding him, even if the technology.
Oh, I agree. I agree. The presentation, the mood is wonderful.
And even even his little bit about the phosphorescent algae and being in the scuba diving and seeing that sort of thing. If you've ever been scuba diving and seen that sort of thing, there is an analogy there. Yeah,
He's a cocksmith too because he's about. Never mind. I'm sorry. Did I say that out loud?
You just said that out loud.
Oh, golly.
She has no idea who she's getting involved with.
Ladies, always do your background. Now you got Facebook and you can check up on him. He'd be like, he'd be putting on his wall, just knocked over a bank today.
When you see his Facebook that he's a fan of machine gun clubs.
Red flag. Red flag.
Red flag.
That's right.
I like the shimmering lights in that shot especially. That was great.
Another thing I like about Michael Mann, his fetishes, boat, car,
yeah,
gun, he's, all that sort of thing. He just goes crazy for it. And it's,
well, it goes back to the also the realism he tries to bring to all the movies. Like, he literally took Pacino, Kilmer, Sizemore, all those guys, and he went and even Studi and Pacino and everybody else that was going to be shooting guns, and took them to a fully automatic gun range with tactical officers showing them what to do. And they literally laid out the gunfight that they do later at the bank job. And they're shooting live rounds. They're doing all that stuff. So he's not pussyfooting to give them quarter loads and everything else for blanks. They're shooting live rounds.
They're shooting rounds.
They're doing everything into targets.
Wow.
And that there is something
paid
to
off.
That.
It paid off. Absolutely.
I'm not. Sure. They're not shooting live rounds in the bank job. If that's true. But I'm talking
no,
about
no. In practicing, yeah. In training, and that's still shooting live rounds is pretty big. But yeah. Oh, in that.
Here
in
we
that,
go. We have the muted scene with De Niro, quiet, calm, controlled, and in walks Pacino.
I heard one time. I think Pacino was saying that he part of his character was that this guy either did coke and was kind of like a dirty cop on the side and you just never really see it, and that's how he kind of came at it, or he was always on coke. And if you look at this scene whenever he's interrogating this guy, you can easily see that. You're like, okay, you know.
I buy that. Yeah, yeah. I completely
okay.
buy that.
All right. That would explain a lot, including what's coming up.
And I think I even heard that he was saying, like, that's how he knows some of these vagrants and stuff that he's going interrogating and finding out, is that those are his guys. Those are his connections and everything else. So he kind
of... Why they have sort of almost like a friendly relationship.
Exactly,
like,
yeah. I might be wrong in
the
that.
The doorman at the club, he walks up behind and pretends to put a gun in his back.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Ooh, that's very interesting.
No, I like that. That
ooh, yeah.
That gives, yeah, that's interesting. I'd never thought of that before. And, of course, his...
So, basically, you're saying that here, he's basically...
He's wired.
He's snorted a few lines here,
he's
at least.
He's whacked out, yeah.
Okay.
He's done a few bumps.
So, basically...
His girlfriend
likes
the pills,
is that the terminology, done a few bumps? I've never done coke before, so that's it.
Done a rail, yeah. A bump is off the nail.
Go, Curtis.
Rail.
Go, Curtis. Go.
What do you
want to
do? Come on.
Go, Curtis.
Here he is.
Like when he blew up right there, Michael, is that what you're laughing at?
Yeah, exactly. The best is later on with the when he starts talking about the Hank Azaria's relationship with Ashley Judd, and
she's got a great ass.
She's
and
got
your
a
head
great
is,
ass,
and your head is completely stuck up at it.
Yeah, he starts singing, dude.
Now it all makes sense.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, also,
you
see Diane Venora. I mean, I guess whenever you see her, she's smoking a joint. So, I mean, they actually show it, as opposed to, I mean, not that someone wouldn't do that, but still. And especially this is 95 in the movies, you didn't necessarily show that. So I could see that. Like, this is like the story that got cut out.
Well, I mean, that was that whole scene in the beginning of the film that doesn't really make that much sense to you at the time till later on, where you see Natalie Portman's mother, and she's completely stoned and disassociated from what's going on, and Natalie Portman gets really upset, and you have no idea why.
Here's your cameo.
Yeah, there he is.
Tom Noonan, Francis Dollarhide.
Plays an amazing Tooth Fairy. Tooth Fairy and Manhunter.
Yeah. Yes. That was Francis Dollarhide.
Yeah.
Which, when they redid as Red Dragon...
And
who played?
Yeah,
someone else played.
Which, by the way, Dante Spinotti also was cinematographer on Red Dragon.
Oh, really?
It was the British actor, Ralph Fiennes.
Oh.
Who played Tooth Fairy in
the
Red Dragon remake, which wasn't as, because in the book, if you've ever read the book, and just to get off on half a second, he's a total giant. He's like 6'6", muscular, athletic.
No, okay.
Whereas in Ralph, anyway.
Well, Ralph Fiennes is pretty tall.
There's,
but yeah,
there's something
like
to be said for Hannibal Lecter in Manhunter as well, too.
Which was Brian Cox.
Brian Cox, yes.
Yeah. I haven't seen Manhunter in years. It's on the list. I got to redo my Michael Mann.
Very good. It's got
early Michael Mann.
Best use of Inigata
DeVita. I was
ever
about to say that.
Great scene where he does the slow-mo through the window.
William Peterson as the detective in that. Yeah,
and,
as FBI agent.
To even do a little bit more Six Degrees of Kevin Bacon, if you go to... Thief, he has a small little cameo where he plays like a bouncer at a bar, and that's Will Peterson with a big giant beard. And you're like, that's Will. and he literally has two lines in the movie. So, you know.
And I love how in that last scene, it wasn't high noon. It was near more towards golden hour. Just
rise
all the
above,
mood, beautiful
rise
lighting.
Above.
I want to know where that is in L.A. And actually, this is an interesting turning point in the plot because basically now it's turning towards what they're doing with the with
name
the money.
Your punk rock lead singers. Anyone?
William,
anyone?
William Fichtner, who is a
William Fichtner is a punk Fichtner? Rock lead singer.
We just saw in Batman when we did the commentary for Batman.
Henry Rollins.
There we go. Lead singer Black Flag.
I know. I mean, he's nice. I think he's a weak link in this film, but it's okay.
I think he does the job for what it is. Yeah,
I know. It's like, oh, let's cast Henry Rollins. That'll be fun. But William Fichtner is awesome. And, I mean, he's in the past few years, he's really gotten some great roles on TV. He did Invasion, where he was really good. And then Prison Break, very, very good.
And he was the one that was in Contact, right?
And he was great in Contact.
He was wonderful in Contact.
He was absolutely wonderful.
That's the first time
because usually he played,
learned of him.
He played asses.
Contact.
He played like in here, real assholes. Mm-hmm. He was great at playing bad guys.
Also
did you ever see Go?
Armageddon. He was the bad astronaut in Armageddon that wanted to detonate the bomb on the surface of them. I know this is really making
have we really brought up Armageddon?
I've completely blanked out.
Armageddon, come on, is like Anaconda. You kind of got to watch it for the fact that it is kind of cheesy.
Kind of. Okay, where
that
is this?
It looks like the 101 to me.
This is...
But it's
that's
too,
a great... I mean, talk about locations.
You do locations.
That
Michael, where is it?
Angle.
You get the highway.
Guess what freeway
Well, you
is.
Had that. It was out of focus in the scene with the guy in the wheelchair on the porch. It was in their background, and now they're showing it for what it is. It's a great
I mean, some high, it looks
vantage
like it's somewhere
point.
Close to downtown.
What's
maybe
good,
off Mahalo.
What's really cool about this movie is it makes you see how you could easily be a very unclean person in L.A. and going to be shady and kind of do things behind right under everybody's noses just by these locations you see. Spinotti, by the way, did do the DP work for Red Dragon.
Yeah, that's
remake,
what I was saying.
And L.A. Confidential was his big one.
Right. That was beautifully
LA Confidential,
shot.
Absolutely.
L.A. Confidential was great.
Yeah. Actually, here's his place. Look how sterile it is. His personal life.
Well, there's a joke here where Val Kilmer says, you know, when are you going to get some more furniture? Because he's laying on the floor and there's nothing really to lay on in there.
Yeah. Yeah, there you go.
With that view, I don't need furniture.
Yeah.
And Spinotti did do Public Enemy with him, so.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Yeah.
So they kissed and made up. That's good.
But and not look, collateral.
Look, and his clothing matches his decor.
My favorite film.
He's got four dishes. He's like you, Tim.
I have less than that.
My favorite film of Michael Mann's that a lot of people have not seen, just because I think it was a subject that most people weren't that interested in, is The Insider. I thought it's just one of the greatest films and just such great performances in that.
I like the key on. Well, look at that key on De Niro.
It's pretty hot.
It's hot, but it's a cooler color temperature. Look at that. Maybe it's the way they timed it, but it's also paled out in that way that it's like the yellow's been taken out.
I like it whenever they have scenes framed like that with actors close right next to camera because you realize how and what the fuck is that on Val Kilmer's arm? The whole movie I'm watching that and I'm like, what is that? And does Val bring that in there or did, like he had his elbow broke one time in a shady deal or something? I mean, what is it? Did that drive you crazy when you saw it first?
Mm. I'm trying to figure out his tattoos.
Yeah, that's what catches my eye in the scene is his tattoos that just creep out from underneath the sleeves.
I like this scene just because it breathes. It's nice.
Oh, yeah.
Well, the quiet. I love films with a lot of like really quiet rhythms. Films that are just too much. I mean, Run, Little Run or something like that, it's great on occasion, but films that are just constant, you know, pushing a lot of edits and a lot of...
A barrage of stimulus.
Yeah, just a barrage of stimulus. Yeah. Don't do it for me nearly so much as a film that's got a lot of just really quiet, rhythmic moments.
My favorite moments in film are where I feel the audience is a fly on the wall.
Great shot.
You know? Mm-hmm. Then you just happen to be watching something unfold in front of you very naturally.
Absolutely. But even Run, Little Run, not to digress to that, I mean, it allows itself to unfold. Oh, there's the President of the United States, Dennis Haysbert.
That's Joe Boo. Come on. If you're a fan of baseball in Major League, that's Joe Boo.
He was in Major League?
Absolutely he was in Major League.
Oh, that's a similar role.
I saw Major League like when it
well,
first came out.
Wasn't he replaced in one of the sequels or something?
No, you're thinking of Wesley Snipes.
Oh, that's right. That's
third
right.
One. Come on now.
That's right.
And,
by Omar. Well,
isn't his wife... the famous, what's the actress's name? I can't think of her name. Played
Name that actor in front of us. Who is that?
I can't think of it.
The wife looked a little bit like Alfre Woodard.
No, it's not Alfre
no,
Woodard.
No, it's not. Who's the actress that played Tina Turner?
Yeah,
it's not
was
her.
Was that her?
Angela Bassett. No, that's not Angela Bassett. That's Bud Cort.
No, I've heard a lot of people complain about the storyline in these scenes, that it sort of pulls away from the overall narrative, and you know that it basically these scenes are sort of throwaway scenes. But to me, I really like his scenes and what happens here. And I'll agree that it doesn't move the overall narrative in a lot of ways, but it just works for me.
I think it's a great subplot that basically blends into the late second act, part where they actually need someone, and then he's there. So it's a great way to introduce it, and also
give that guy character. So when the guy does end up he's not just another guy that they call on the phone. Hey, can you help me out and be a driver today?
Yeah,
you know, where it actually means something when he does end up dying, and you see the consequences of being a part of these guys or with these guys.
Absolutely. But okay. if you lost that scene, you wouldn't understand the story any less from it being removed.
Well, it fleshes out the people that inhabit this world.
I love that you're watching touches like that, as opposed to not having it. I would
the girlfriend of the guy, when her reaction, you know what she had invested in him and how he turned his back on that and everything that she was trying to, bring around that would be good for both of them. It registers so much more.
And I like the fact that, half that scene was played the back of De Niro's head. I dig that stuff. And then all they do is move the camera to get to the front of his face instead of him turning around again.
Now, wait a minute. Could you call payphones back in 95? Was that still,
sure.
is that a movie moment there?
What, you couldn't call payphones?
Like, you can't call payphones back, right? Didn't they
did they stop that?
In a lot of cities, haven't they made it to where you can't call because of the...
Are there still payphones?
At 95, I'm sure you could have. Most
95, I'm sure it functions just like
now,
a phone.
Now you're lucky if you see one. The other day
I saw one,
and I was like, hey, the payphone. And then I saw it was ripped out. I'm like, no, there's not a payphone there.
There are no more any payphones.
Yeah.
My favorite is the... there's a payphone up on Mulholland, like a little payphone thing up on Mulholland by Coldwater.
Yeah.
Like, what's that doing there? There's nothing there.
What I like about this
is a great scene.
Well, the character development what I like about this as far as De Niro's character goes is he's a shady guy that does all these bad deeds. He's a bank robber and a heist, all this other stuff, but yet he's still got morals.
Well, he's got morals, but he keeps it straight because he needs Chihurlis. I mean, he cares for him, and he needs him to stay on mission, and she's basically, fracking it all up by doing what she's doing. She's messing with him
absolutely
so bad. He needs him to stay on, and he cares for him, too.
Which
it's all about
see,
keeping the team together.
But I think it's number one first. I think it's his buddy first.
They're kind of like mixed together.
There's a little bit of a difference, which you'll see in the film, in what De Niro says and the way he... In everything that he says in his dialogue, it's all motivated towards the team and towards making sure that the job gets done and this sort of professional demeanor of his. What you see in some other little moments where it's not his dialogue is that he's motivated by a lot of other things as well. And that's really, really gets interesting for me to see the difference between the way he speaks to people and then these quiet little moments where he's not saying anything and the other sorts of... emotions and thoughts that he's having.
I think what's really thrilling and amazing about this film is the way it like goes across so many different plots, and you can still
know the doorman.
Where you are.
The doorman that he's probably bought coke off before.
Yeah,
that's right.
But it's true. Like, hey. For me, when I watched this film, I understood every character's motivation.
Yep.
It's all mapped out what you get to know what each person wants.
And where they are.
The wants
and
of each
there, yeah.
person and how it works against the other. Everyone wants that specific goal.
And look at this. He walks right around there.
Yeah.
So clearly he has privileges.
Yeah, he's been to this club more than once.
And there's his buddy. And then we have a little House of Pain playing in the background. Go
oh,
on.
That's right.
Yeah, you know,
House
some
of
the
Pain.
Music
nice.
Choices I don't know about.
Wait, you don't like House of Pain?
Did you notice the dancer in the background?
I don't know that it fits.
No,
not even 95, but in 95 you were kind of stuck in that era of techno coming in and all this.
Who was the dancer in the background?
Well, the fact that Pacino's walking towards the camera, a dancer in the background, once Pacino moves past that dancer, slides backwards to remain in frame while Pacino keeps walking. It was not
15 minutes.
Subtle at all.
Oh, wow. You see, I didn't notice that, but that's okay.
And yes, this ladies guy, and gentlemen, that is Tone Loc.
That's right.
Funky Cold Actually, Medina.
You know what? And he does a good job here. He really does.
I always love Tone Loc.
Come on, Ace Ventura.
I cannot love Tone Loc.
He's got a great voice.
Anybody else pick up Ford Fairlane? He also is in that.
What's really interesting about it is you watch him, and it's like this guy is like stuck in his, this is what I need from you, and he just doesn't understand what Pacino is asking him and what he's got to do. It's like, this is what I want.
Get killed walking your doggy.
Walking your doggy. That was the best line in reading in the face of the planet.
Yeah, you know,
so,
it really,
so that was a missing scene when he came into the club and he stopped in the corner and then he came
yeah,
to the
exactly.
club.
Yeah,
that's
yeah,
right.
Yeah. No, that was on the elevator ride up.
Oh, okay,
OCI
that's right.
Kinda,
yeah.
Okay, man.
Yes, we're listening to the movie.
Yeah.
I'm just watching Pacino chewing his gum and being manic. He's manic.
Yeah, you know, there's this shark-like quality. It's like if he can't stop moving or swimming or he's going to, you know, die. There's this predatorial shark thing where he's just got to constantly be moving. And it all builds up into that bank scene where, you know, you see him as this predator more and more. As the story develops.
See, I like how he says he can make the call. It's like,
see, what
you haven't done anything.
What I like about in this whole movie so far, in all these two shots, they'll have the master two shot where you have Tone Loc and Al Pacino in the same scene, but then they'll have like Tone Loc, and then you'll just have the side of Pacino's face, and then they'll cut back to the other actor, and it's just the side of Al Pacino's face, just still in frame, and it has no reason to be there. And it would look a lot cleaner to not have it, but I like having it in there.
Yeah.
Now this is like the first piece of information. This is like the first connection he's made to actually figuring out what's going on with the heist. Yeah, calling him Slick.
And again, overall, really, the feel of this film, it is shot tight. I mean, he's just right in on these faces all the time.
Well, he's not afraid to come in tight. I mean, he starts out wider, so we know where we are. We know where we are. Yes.
There's not much like this shot right here. That's wide. There's not
much of
that. The
good thing
is
they didn't have to
this is a medium shot.
They didn't have to go out and find an actual or make up a crime photo of Tom Sizemore. They just were like they just went down to the local LAPD and was like, "Hey, by the way, can we use that for our actor?" Yep. Perfect. Bad. I like Wes Studi in this film. I mean, he's one of those he it's unfortunate because he's American Indian. He always gets cast as American Indian, but he's so good in this, just in the secondary character.
Last of the Mohicans, just fantastic. Phenomenal.
Well, I mean, all the guys on the team, essentially, you know, they have their part, and they're part of the fabric of it. I mean, we don't forget. You know, actually, it reminds me of a Sharky's Machine. You ever see that?
Yes.
With just that whole team thing. This scene.
I love this scene.
It's a great scene.
I love this scene. Another thing about this movie, too, is this sound design. If you can ever see
look
this on
shot.
A really good
that's
sound.
The widest shot so far.
Amazing.
That's on yeah, a major, major crane way up high.
And for all the little kiddies out there, that is called a drive-in theater. Drive-in theaters actually used to show theaters outside, and you pulled up those little poles and
in your car.
The sound in your car, in and your you put car. The speaker in your window. Horrible speakers. I'd like to know where that's at because it's got a major freeway behind it and it looks like it's in L.A., but it must not be there
now.
No,
it's got to be somewhere out east.
Wow, this is 95. It could be condos now.
Yeah, I doubt it's a driving theater at the moment.
It doesn't exist anymore. Now, in a way, going back to it, what I'm saying is I think this is, like, because this is a long film, this is essentially what it feels like is, the second act? I think we're into the second act already, definitely.
Reflections.
Oh, yeah. And then, of course, you find out another level of this.
Oh, there's Val.
There's Val Kilmer. Oh, what he does is awful. Oh, man.
Well, like, Val was still thin enough to get in that little
it's
spot.
Like, what were they thinking? Oh. What were these guys thinking? You know, you come here and you think you can do that. These guys are not going to be prepared.
Well, see, that's the thing is that's what's so great about the De Niro character and everybody else in his team. They are so prepared. That's what's really awesome
but
about
that
like,
everyone
the
underestimated them on this thing is it's just wow. And this is great. Oh man. Here it is. Where is it? There he is. He's shooting through the What's windshield. That? And then one shot turns that way, another shot turns in the other way, and then boom, up and over the car. That's a great stunt.
Yeah, and this guy's dead.
He just here we go.
That's the thing.
Here comes
exactly.
Tom Sizemore.
And then, yeah.
With the shotgun.
It's like, and the thing is, they don't hesitate. It's like, you know what? You crossed us. If you just done what you said you were going to do, everything would have been fine. But because you tried to kill us, we're going to kill you.
That's
which is the mores of this film.
That's why later it's such a great payoff whenever William Fichtner's on the phone with him and he's like,
That's right.
It's the greatest line reading right here. Yeah.
It's right here.
Dead man.
It's right here. It's this
classic De Niro.
Right here.
As an actor, you must die for lines like that.
Like, who's this? That's a great shot of him.
And may I say, I like the way the white pickup truck just sputtered to a slow halt at the end rather than slamming into the wall and exploding that you'd see on every TV show.
Yes.
It was a good representation of death to watch that truck just die into the wall.
I like that they're in a restaurant kitchen. It's like they have a restaurant kitchen they can go to make phone calls.
And De Niro's like, forget about the money.
Henry Rollins completely works in this. He's just sort of blurry thug in the background.
I'm sorry. This is De Niro's best role. I know Godfather Part Two, he was really, really good as a younger man, but I don't know what.
I think Meet the Fockers.
Okay, what about Raging Bull?
That's one that really, to the fore.
I guess he's got Raging many Bull great like roles.
Deer
Taxi
Hunter.
Driver, I guess.
Deer one. Hunter.
Taxi. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, Deer Hunter. That's
the guy has an incredible body of work. You can't really.
The Beer Hunter also? No. But I just think in this one, for some reason, this is his one role that appeals to me.
Watch this scene with De Niro. This is what I'm talking about with the no dialogue sort of thing. Watch him react to the sort of all the families around him, and you can tell that he's the solo guy and he's chosen to live his life that way, but he's having some regrets about that.
Right, because he calls Amy Brenneman right after.
So he's laughing. You watch him, he's laughing at everybody, but
this scene is all about him.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah, there's the empty chair next to him.
A lot of coupling.
Yeah.
And family.
Agitated, he gets up and goes and calls.
The chicky chicky.
Mm-hmm. And does a complete lie here on the phone, by the way.
What is
She says, oh, I was thinking it was a one-night thing. He says, oh, it wasn't for me. It
so
was
it
then.
It was
it's
before
not
the
now.
Table scene.
Exactly.
No. Nice.
I like the blue behind his hair head.
I would like to see the other set of jacks over there, on the top of her bookshelf. And what's the bouncy ball she uses with her jacks there?
I got to tell you, I really like the use of corded phones in these films, as opposed to pulling out a cell phone anywhere.
Mm.
It's sort of like the one
nostalgia.
Thing that's kind of because it becomes a device in films, and how do you use it?
There's some good widescreen composition with the actors that are on top looking down. It's a good scope shot. They're right there.
Right.
I like that. That's nice.
That's a tough shot to do right there.
Yeah.
And make it look reasonable.
In reality, they're like 8 feet apart.
I mean, that's a CinemaScope shot. You just line them up.
Yep. Oh, yeah.
See, 1, 2, 3, 4 guys all right in the row.
And what's interesting is, as a star, they don't put Pacino in the front. You know, isn't that interesting?
He's out of focus.
Yeah.
Then you just rack focus over.
Yeah. Well, he's amongst his men. And then there's
he's sort of in the middle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're a team. I mean, he is the lead. But
look, he's the one who's in focus there for the most part, though, in that shot. They drop, what's his name, out of focus.
So now that because they follow, and I just like this. Now, I don't like zooms, but that's a great use of a zoom right there.
I missed it.
They just moved in on the sign, so you knew that they were behind the sign.
You don't like zooms? Apparently, you've never seen Army of Darkness, because if ever was a movie that made a great use of zooms.
Army of Darkness. I go to sleep every night to Army of Darkness. There you go.
Absolutely.
Shot right off that 118.
For me, there's Robert De Niro 14. And there's Bruce Campbell.
I think some films you can use zooms and it's acceptable. Most films, I really don't.
Like, well, I think you don't like the late 60s into the early 70s Zooms.
Yes.
That's when they were really
that then became,
gung-ho with their new toy.
That then became the like the way to lazily compose things in the 70s and the 80s and into the 90s. And I mean, here, clearly, there's none of that. So that's why I'm saying judicious use is awesome. Non-judicious, lazy use is not.
I love that you know there's a threat in this scene from the moment you see him shirtless and he's got the swastika on him and he's, you know, with a young African-American girl. You just know as soon as you see that, even before he starts making faces, that, that something bad is going to happen here. Look at those eyes, man.
That line right there, you don't even know what this is.
Yeah.
That's scary.
Yeah, I mean, Kevin Gage. No, it's. I mean, but Kevin Gage. Well, the good thing about this is they cut it off. It's good, and they cut it off short instead of effective. Kevin Gage does a really great job of being a major bad guy in this.
It's a good move right there.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Nice cut.
That's all we needed. Yeah.
We didn't need anything else.
The bottle top coming off.
And the great thing is that I think in like when we see Pacino next, when he gets the call and he comes to the crime scene, that's when we find out just, and that's like one thing we don't even know about this guy, how bad this guy actually is and that he's actually killed multiple people.
Exactly.
Way.
So when you just called attention to the bottle top coming off, he decapitated her, right?
No, he does not decapitate
her, but
that implied sort of violence just from the violence of the bottle top being ripped off.
Yeah,
you
it's
know?
The sound effect.
I saw a bottle top coming up, and it turns out he decapitated her. That's like, oh, there's some imagery. Okay.
Yeah, look at the sea of black suits and muted colors.
Now, here you have... go ahead. You go.
No, I was just going to say probably what you're saying. Go ahead.
Well, basically, you had one, you know, the bad guys have their party scene. They have the good guys have their party scene. They're get-together.
Exactly.
They're celebrating whatever they're celebrating.
Well, what's interesting, what it's showing is that they're really kind of the same people.
Yeah.
And I think I heard even Michael Mann talk about it one time. It's like one group chose their way, which isn't it's a dishonorable way as far as society goes, but it's not so much more honorable or dishonorable, or they're just family guys just like these are. They have their own life and they have their own ways of doing things, but it's the correlation is very similar.
Exactly. Well, and you get that with De Niro and Pacino too in the beginning. Immediately what you feel them as foils, and their aspects are different. He's so noisy, and he's De Niro sort of quiet and controlled. But then as the movie progresses, you start to sense that they're really very similar. And in a lot of ways, it's Pacino is really more of the bad guy because he's this complete predator, as you find out. When, you know, by the time he shoots that guy, that first shot that he takes, I think it's Tom Sizemore down.
Oh yeah,
that there's this sort of like predatorial release for him, like he's just this animal that's just, you know, hunted down somebody else.
Well, on that same note, if you ever do, which I highly recommend, like I did before, rent the movie Thief.
Yeah, I need to see that.
And on the commentary of that, Michael Mann talks about that, and he did with the police officer. Well, Michael Mann's such an attention to detail. He hires a lot of police officers, and he hires for Thief. He hired a bunch of thieves from Chicago at that time, who were these famous diamond thieves that just had all this money under their belt and all these heists under their belt, and these cops could never find them, but they knew exactly who they were. They knew where they lived. But the whole story being is years after, what do they call it whenever you can no longer be tried for the same crime that you did like 10 years ago or whatever?
The statute
of limitations had passed up. So he had gotten the thieves to be the technical advisors on the film, they played the cops in the movie, and he got the cops that were the technical advisors for the cops during that same, all this stuff.
And they
played
the thieves?
And they played the thieves. He said, but what's so funny about it was, is when these guys got together and they all drank beers and hung out, they were they were joking, they loved each other, they were having a great time with each other, so they were so similar in a lot of their ways.
Right. Two things.
This is actually... I've kind of gone back and forth on whether I like the scene or not, but I think I really do like this scene.
For me, the music, the cue in this sequence took me out of the film. It called attention to itself. It's unlike any other cue for the rest of the film, orchestrally. Mm-hmm. For some, whatever reason, it was too much for me. But I love the location. This location is awesome.
For me, what it does is when you look at Pacino, I don't know, I watch and I'm like, Pacino here is confronted with like such emotion with what this is all about that he already feels about it. And it changes a little something in him. And he's just like, do I need to have any more of this kind of thing? I mean, I don't know. It's kind of...
It's the preface for the conversation that's about to happen is what it is.
Right.
Is it his girlfriend or his wife? I never get that.
That's his wife. His third wife.
So it's his wife sort of comes after him for his lifestyle here, and he's just had this horrible moment, and that's kind of what that was about, this building up to this right here.
Mm-hmm. Well, it gives him an excuse to be the way he is right here.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think it's an excuse. He's just explaining how he is. This is what he does. And he's explained it earlier, and he has to explain it yet again. He explained it at the beginning.
Well, what her response is even better, because she just sums him up right here in this mm-hmm. conversation.
Mm-hmm. I can't imagine how it would work if someone, that's their life, and that's not just their job, but that's what they immerse themselves in
sure.
when they're outside the house, and they're expected to come home from that and...
Mm-hmm. And just be on. Yeah.
Shut it off and go directly into something else. I don't know how that would ever work. You can see exactly where they're both coming from.
Sure.
You see exactly where she's coming from, exactly where he's coming from, exactly how it's not working because of that.
Exactly.
I understand both of them.
Well, it's acting 101. It's coming from the highest drama. What is it?
Hmm.
I think he did some coke before this scene, too.
So he's not just eccentric, huh?
But they're also deflating, you know, in a way Michael Mann's taking, deflating the whole thing of the cop who can deal with his life, deal with all the horror, basically, you know, and a cop would see this type of stuff and still be able to hold his shit together. And he's saying, well, no, actually, you see that stuff, it does affect you. I mean, it's clearly affected this guy. This guy is not healthy, you know, emotionally.
Yeah, how can you compartmentalize it? It's going to leak over.
And he says he can't. Yeah, exactly. He's like, I'm. You love me, and that's great, but I can't tell you about that stuff.
This actress, do I know her?
Diane or Diana Venora?
Who, other work, anything of importance that sticks
out?
This
is probably the biggest thing she did. She did other stuff, did TV stuff, too.
She's very good in this. Mm-hmm. So she just said, "Sense of your prey, you hunt them down." And Michael, you were talking about being a predator.
Yeah, exactly. That's, I mean, that pretty much sums up his character. It's what he gets out of bed for. Otherwise, he would have jumped in a bathtub with a toaster a long time ago, I think.
But that's how he's developed. That's how he's adapting. I mean, who knows how he got to where he was here, but that is how he lives.
Instead, it's his, adopted daughter that jumps in the bathtub? Is that his? Not his real daughter. That's
his wife's daughter from a previous marriage.
Right.
But, and now we have our second Dennis Haysbert scene.
There's something he said there, an interesting idea of surrogate suicide in that scene. I hadn't thought of it that way before.
Hmm.
Yeah, in a way, she is what he would be if he couldn't handle things.
Exactly. Yeah, I hadn't thought of it that way before.
Yeah, wow, yeah. Interesting. Yeah, but he's obviously he's managed to adjust. He's, I mean, obviously, whatever, he became a cop and did whatever. I mean, I guess the flip question is, would he have ever been like Robert De Niro's character, like Neil McCauley?
Hmm. I like the way this scene comes right after the couple's confrontation of Pacino and his wife. You go to one to the next.
And what's interesting in the way they did it is that it's a secondary character who really we've only seen once before this. It's kind of interesting.
But thematically, his story fits with their story too, which is interesting.
Well, I mean, yeah. I agree.
And then we have another couple's scene, right?
Nice. Yeah. I didn't notice this
modern
the first
day
time
times,
I watched it.
Though, you would have to lose that. Either the writers would have to write it out, or like the excuse would be, well, we don't need that in there because they're not pivotal to the scene.
But this is why Michael Mann is such a strong director, because he said, I want this in here, and it's here for a very important reason, and it works.
And that's why I see this as an ensemble piece.
And I 100% agree with you. It does work.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it is masterful. That's the whole thing, because technically speaking, it shouldn't work, but he makes it work. And now here he's basically introducing the idea of taking off.
And I've got to say, you know, for her to just go, okay, la, 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 you're sort of like, you might want to know more about this person. Even if you didn't think that they were a criminal and a killer, at least you'd want to know a little bit more, wouldn't you, before you jet off with someone?
Check his Facebook profile.
Yeah. Yeah. Knight in shining armor, Tim. That's what chicks all dig about. Guys.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, well, who's chicks. This guy? He's like,
chicks.
But, yeah, they were born to give you a feeder.
But there's no context. She has no idea. I mean, all she can think is, like, he's mysterious. Maybe he does some weird little
thing.
Well,
he has lied to her already. Yeah, he works in metals. That was what he said earlier. I mean, okay. He lied to her.
But,
son of a bitch.
Right, but she doesn't know that. And
that's why it's a lie.
You're peeking there, my friend.
To all those listeners out there who whose ears are still ringing, please stay with us.
That's why it's a lie. But the thing is, she doesn't know. She, for her context,
that's why it's a lie.
Well, but her window of understanding of who he is it's like this. She can't even conceive of what he could possibly be.
That's it. If this were a romantic comedy, you'd say absolutely. Go off with the guy. But
exactly.
Isn't that funny how we look at things different ways?
And that's the point. In the context,
exactly.
We don't know.
Yeah.
If you took out all this crime scene, you know, all this crime mm-hmm. scenes, you'd be like, well, what's going on? And at the end, she finds out that he was this.
Yeah.
So in that sense, it's understandable. And she's having trust and faith and wow.
It's interesting, too, that he's more connected with the daughter that isn't his than his own wife.
Or,
in a lot of ways.
And her father is barely connected. But the important thing, actually, is that she's connected to him.
Yeah.
She knows, because remember, she chooses his hotel room to basically do what she does later.
And earlier in that first scene, he never recognizes the irony of him, you know, heckling the father who's not there and not involved in the relationship while he's doing the same thing with his wife.
Excuse me a second.
Good point.
This is a great shot coming in over LA and coming, it was beautiful at night and coming down.
Nice
and tracking,
film stock.
Tracking
that light.
And that's 95. So, well, I mean, they had fast film stocks then.
Oh, yeah.
Look at that.
Oh, yeah.
Look at the parking lot. You can see every detail with those lights in there.
Absolutely. Wow.
You know, very smooth.
All you're doing is you're shooting. You're seeing the green of the fluorescence.
Very smooth. Look at that.
Oh, nice helicopter shot. And then, of course, that's the trucks
where
they
are. Here
the
comes that
are.
Great lighting shot where he steps out of the shadows.
Oh, yeah. That's somewhere off of downtown. But anyway, I think the thing with the Natalie Portman thing with the character is that she does identify with him, and that's the thing they're saying. She is, in a way, she's a reflection of Satellite. Oh, this dude! It's like you already the way he's acting. It's like, dude, you're totally being unprofessional.
There's something even about him having that bottle of water.
Well, that's what it is. Yeah. That's what makes him unprofessional. So you know something bad's going to happen because he's being such an idiot. It's like you don't
do anything.
Those are some dated
glass frames, too.
at least the hairstyles aren't too dated.
No.
But the glasses frames and the phones are.
Glasses do it. You got to watch glasses.
Yeah. Oh, you see, he works in metals.
He works in metal.
He just happens to be going into a metal place. I just love that they can do so many different things. And here he is. He's climbing. He knows how to climb a telephone pole.
Well, this is around the same time as The Saint, right? And in The Saint, his whole role was to take on other people and to do everything.
Yeah, which was not... I mean, it was an entertaining film, not a great film. Elizabeth Shue was in that.
Great. To be the nuclear scientist or something, whatever
that was
her
like,
role was.
That was like Denise Richards in the James Bond film.
The world is not enough. Yeah. Oh.
We love you, Elizabeth Shue.
It.
But
I believed
but,
it.
Hey, Elizabeth Shue, you were much... We loved you in Leaving Las Vegas.
Yeah.
You were great.
Absolutely.
Elizabeth Shue, you mean Denise Richards?
Denise Richards is a different deal. She was great in Wild Things. Everyone was great in Wild Things. What am I talking about? Oh, look, it's a shot from The Usual Suspects.
Exactly. Which is, I think, the same year.
Show us your gun.
95?
What's that?
Usual Suspects?
Was it? Crap. I like all of it.
Pretty close.
You're right.
Within a year.
It's right there.
Once again, excellently lit in there. I like that. What's this? Showing the water dripping? It's great. Great touch. That's a wonderfully lit hallway. It's amazing.
Nothing like a good no dialogue setup scene.
Yep. This is
makes me wonder what De Palma would have done with it.
Yep.
This is really, it says De Palma. And now look on,
look on the left screen, what they do, they have the negative image come up of De Niro.
Yeah. Night vision.
Okay, I'm sorry. You're right, infrared. It is actually infrared, yeah. And I like also the use, the use of technology to show, these guys are on, it's like,
real quick.
Douchebag cop.
Look at him.
Douchebag cop with the water bottle blew the hole, and they're looking at each other.
Nice cross cutting.
Amazing. And then we go to this, to the infrared.
And what's so great is it shows.
And it's like he's in his negative image.
We've set up already through this whole movie that how precise he is. Then if at one moment he's ready to, not only through dialogue did he say, you're better be ready to walk away, but.
Right.
This is a huge heist, and it's just like, you know what? Leave it. Nope. Tools stay. Yep. Time to go.
And what was great about that is that they use a technique which he didn't use barely. They both looked into the camera, which Jonathan Demme does a lot, very well. But that's very rare for other filmmakers to do. I like this. We walk. We go.
And he's professional because he does it.
Yep. It's like, all right, going. See you. Bye.
It's the last thing he wants to do in the world, but he does it.
Well, because, I think it's well established that if anyone knows the score as well as Nero, it's Sherlis.
Here Pacino makes a choice not to arrest him for the reasons that he gives, but I think even more so it's because there'll be no satisfaction in the hunt aspect of it if he took him down right now.
So he let his personal convictions overshadow things?
Well, no, I don't think that's... the points he make are reasonable that they can't, tried for anything more than breaking and entering at this point, so far as I know. But at a personal level, I think he knows he'd get no satisfaction in the completion of it if they arrested him now.
Yeah, exactly.
There'll be much more to savor. Yeah,
exactly,
ahead.
Exactly. If he just
waits. Sweeter victory up ahead. Yeah,
but also, his point is that they haven't stolen anything.
Exactly, right,
it's breaking and entering. They're not going to get them on anything. They won't get anything they're looking for. Oh, man.
And there they go.
And there they, yeah. But, the thing is, they're still tailing them. They know where they are.
Oh, yeah. The hunt is still on.
After in that truck for hours with the other man's stench.
I love what she says earlier, his wife, about him circling his prey. Because that's what, from this point on, is all he does, is he circles the prey.
And what happens now is it's the first part where now the prey starts circling back.
Exactly.
And that's what the whole
build
whole
up to the cafe
now.
Scene where they have coffee together.
Yep. And the interesting thing is they can't figure out how the cops got onto them, and it never plays out. We never have to have them find out, oh, this is how we got onto you. It's like the different stories, the different pools of knowledge kind of, exist on their own, but they still wind up moving towards each other.
Something we haven't talked about is Danny Trejo.
Oh, the great Danny Trejo. Trejo, yeah.
The thing about him was this was a big movie for him at the time. He had never really, he'd always done the character pieces up until this time, always a second bad lead or whatever, a third guy, and always kind of the So to actually be a part of this group and have a pivotal part later, whenever he gets the whole the beating scene that where he gives up the information, mm-hmm. and he's such a pivotal part of the team, this is a big role for him.
Tom Sizemore's character doesn't have that moment in this movie. The only thing he has is in the fountain at the shootout, right? That's really involved. He doesn't have his
this is, I mean, yeah, where he has to make his own decision. Hmm. I mean,
well, you find out who he is right here.
As far as heavy drama, I mean, he doesn't have a heavy drama moment besides being shot down in the fountain. But
this point he makes right here is, I think, his character.
What's the point that he makes?
He says, for me, the action is the juice, not the money, not all the stuff that he has.
Because he tells him to take off, go live with your life, go with your family.
Because he's got apparently money in other areas now, investments, and he doesn't really need the money. But he's going to do it anyway.
Right.
Which fits Tom Sizemore to a T.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, Tom Sizemore was actually, you know, a pretty big actor. I mean, he did a lot of character stuff in the 90s.
Of course. He did everything.
Oh yeah,
I mean, he did lots of. Ryan, let's just do the list.
Hey, he was on Shiny Beach, you know, season
was
two.
Was he?
Oh yeah,
no,
season
we're
two.
We're not talking about the crap he did. We're talking about the good stuff he did.
Dude, he was. do not trash Shiny Beach with me. Shiny Beach is one of the best TV series ever. He was awesome. He was very very good in it, and he played
was a good actor.
Really, just great guy, which was different from all the other roles he took on later. Hank Azaria.
Hank Azaria.
Talk about a versatile actor.
Who I think the same year did...
he was already doing The Simpsons by then.
You know, but he did...
Sitcom Talking Heads.
Oh, Birdcage.
Birdcage, thank you.
Oh,
which
yeah.
he was
oh, yeah.
hilarious in.
That guy in a corner looked like an actual cop. If I forget you 10, it was.
Nice framing there.
There's West Studi. Yes.
Everyone's so dressed up. I like that. Everyone's got a suit.
That's Michael Mann.
They dress up to go to work. Oh, man. Oh, here it comes. Here's a great line about the ass. Oh, he said ass? It's already working.
But I like that Hank Azaria did not react
that reaction.
To it.
He's just
aghast.
He's just like, "What are you? What is your problem, buddy?
Who is this guy?"
I know.
Look at his eyes right there. So you know he's probably wired. Come on.
But he's wired, but he's got it under control in a way.
Yeah.
He's just he gives him the extra juice, so to speak. And then this is, I mean, I would say this is the midpoint. Are we at the midpoint? Yeah,
nice.
I think we're close to it, the halfway point in the film. And this is where everything just kind of tips the other way.
And I like that this is all just, they're just doing theater right here.
Oh, yeah.
This has nothing to do with anything. They're just drawing out the prey. Drawing out the deer.
So what's Michael Mann done since then, since this? He did...
Insider was after this.
And then he did Collateral after that?
Collateral, I think, is right, yeah.
Collateral, Public Enemies, Miami Vice.
Miami Vice and Public Enemies. So basically, after The Insider, it's all been... video. Well, I won't say that. But.
Well, this is interesting right here because this is whenever De Niro and them is the Pacino actually figures out that it's a setup and this is
what leads
to the whole diner scene. He's like, well, fuck it. If our cards are on the table, then let's just go ahead. And
this is the flip flop of them looking down on.
Right. And this is basically the midpoint where basically now the dynamics switches the other way because now essentially the predator, the hunter, is now becoming partially the prey. So now he's got to essentially step up his game.
It's very well written.
But look how he allows this just to play from his body actions and from...
Yep. And he looks around and he figures it out.
And I love how Pacino's character just loves it. He's like, he loves the fact that his prey is so savvy.
It's almost like a fisherman with a
because he knows it's
hook.
Just going to make it that much better when he takes him down.
But they definitely have a mutual respect.
Yeah.
Oh, and that's the whole thing. Well, I think Pacino has more respect for De Niro. I think De Niro learns to respect him a little, but Pacino, he knows he's got to take him down, but it's like...
This is the point in Jaws when the shark comes after Robert Shaw, and Robert Shaw's like, yeah, man.
Yep.
Anyway, am I?
Well, he admires how formidable his opponent is.
There's a lot of short. We have another hour and a half of this stuff. We only had like about 20, half an hour on for Jaws, and here we go.
That's a lens.
Now, in the Pacino canon of acting, where does this stand? Where does this?
Pacino's the same thing. I mean, you know what? Anything before this, I mean, in the Scent of a Woman, I think, right around there, all that time. After that, I think he realized, kind of like Dustin Hoffman, it's like it's time to make a little money and stop making all these great choices that makes me zero. Where I just might as well just make the money when I can. I guess sometime after this, he's like, you know what? Mm-hmm. He's not done a whole lot of.
Like I said, he kind of becomes a caricature of himself after this time period.
Well, it's after this that De Niro started doing the comedies, right?
Yeah,
like Analyze This and Analyze That.
Oh, both of them kind of did. Yeah,
I mean, Pacino after this did the what was that Colin Farrell movie he did where they were like at the SWAT school or something like that.
Yeah.
Oh, The Recruit?
And then what was the movie that him and De Niro did together recently that got so panned? 88 Minutes or something like that? Or yeah, I mean.
No, I know what you're talking about, but I can't think of it.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, Righteous Kill.
Righteous Kill.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which somehow I have no desire. Well, I don't know, maybe to see them act together, but.
I mean, all that John Voight's done since this movie is like, you know, Jerry Bruckheimer films. it's like everything now, it's like so young that these guys are kind of pushed out. Well, it doesn't matter what their pedigree is.
Yeah.
This DP does a lot of great telephoto stuff. Depth of field, the background's out of focus, foreground.
Could you imagine how far back they are right here for this shot? I mean, I've noticed that the whole shoot is like how out of focus their background is in this whole movie.
Mm-hmm. I love that stuff. It's so moody.
Absolutely.
Good lenses.
I favor that. Which you can't do in 3D.
Really? Mm-hmm.
No.
You can't shoot 3D films that way.
You can't shoot 3D films with the background out of focus?
Correct.
I would say that's a great argument for...
That's what Roger Ebert just came out with a big article. That was one of his gripes, was that you can't do that with 3D.
But that's like, what was it again? Not CinemaScope.
VistaVision? What formats?
How the West Was Won?
Cinerama.
Cinerama also, everything had to be in focus, essentially, right?
Yes, with that lens they're using on the Cinerama camera, you had only one setting, focus-wise. Yeah.
So basically, in that same respect, that's...
You can't do that moody stuff where... Yeah, I mean... What we're looking at here.
The dishes aren't made. Oh, is this the TV scene?
Make the dishes?
This is the suicide.
Washed.
I'm going to wash the bed and make the dishes.
The bed's not made.
This is the hell with you. It's been a long day.
Oh, look, he's in the reflection of the mirror in the back.
Just like the reflection of his TV.
Now, actually, you know, I thought about that. I thought about the TV thing, the reference. I'm like, what the hell is that all about? Perhaps
that's
it's
him.
Perhaps it's a sly little reference to the previous TV movie, L.A. Takedown, saying... He doesn't watch TV. He doesn't pay attention to the previous version. Then when he gets rid of the TV, it's like, that doesn't count. This is a movie.
Hmm. Well, the TV's off.
That's a real cheap interpretation.
Interesting. Interesting take.
Because otherwise the TV doesn't make any sense. It looks like, I mean, it's one possession.
As far as takes, there's more faces on the wall.
Yeah.
Compared to the other one that Curtis pointed out that was
it's a great shot
done that matched her lighting.
Dolly into the back.
Is that supposed to be her looking at?
No
Ooh.
Eyes, sort of looking. Yeah,
oh, that's right. Those are the clues. Those are the clues.
There's that other picture that we just.
Same picture
And what does he do? He's pissed off. I'm going back to work, and I'm going in helicopter.
I'm getting my helicopter.
What I love about this is that he's actually in the helicopter, and they're recording the actual audio from the helicopter, and you can hear that.
I love. Yeah, there's not a rear screen. There's not. I mean, there's a lot of great.
And it's
stuff done.
And it's nice that and shot, loud. Nice. The sound design in this film is this
Great photography. Great. Beautiful.
But there's no reason they would need to fly through the buildings downtown.
But it looks so cool.
But it looks
good.
Why not?
Because it looks awesome. Because you have to get fly through them to get to the 110. Don't you know that?
Oh, he's just following the 110. Is that
that's
what
right? Because yeah. he's on the 110 or something like that, and then from somehow they wind up at Cape Mandalini's from there, which I always thought was interesting. And that's
well
that's
done.
All that's all location sound. That was not dubbed. None of that is dubbed.
Elliot Goldenthal kicks in.
That's right.
With that Miami Vice flavored music.
But yeah.
But you know what? It's a great eclectic soundtrack that he's composed for this film.
No,
it's
not what you'd expect. I love the score. Some of the song choices, not so much, but I love the score in this.
But you don't like House of Pain?
Didn't like that choice of House of Pain for the club.
Oh, it worked for the club. I like how he just takes the car. It's like, see ya. Bye.
It was either that or What is Love, you know? What is love? Baby, don't
I think that was 92 or 93.
Oh, dear.
Oh, yes. Oh. And he's still chewing gum. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
A little bit.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Undercranked.
Yeah, undercranked it. He's definitely cranked.
He's on the edge. That's a great shot. Notice just out of focus in the background. Nice lens.
Yeah. This is one of the few driving scenes, actually, that we've seen. We don't see a lot of them in this, do we?
Electric guitars, wailing. No, not too many in transit in a car.
Okay, wait, what is that? That's the...
L.A. airport. L.A.
They're going on the 110.
It's the 110. Oh, 110 down to...
But this is before the 105 existed, so...
Oh, when the 105 get built? The 105.
It's like 98 or so, right?
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's
been, so how'd you get to the airport from the 110?
You just got off the 405. And did your business. Down Sepulveda.
Okay.
That is very Miami Vice music.
Yeah. Man like the
which was and I like how do you pronounce it? Jan Hammer? He's the one who did
Jan
all the Miami Vice. Is it J-A-N?
I like how he's got his gun and of course Pacino puts his gun on his seat.
Yeah, Pacino should have had a pastel solid color shirt under a suit coat with the sleeves rolled up.
How you doing? Having a good day? Uh-oh, he's looking off to the side, Tim.
Yeah, this brings me to the next scene, which is my Heat drinking game. The first time I saw this movie, the huge famous scene of them in the diner, where De Niro and Pacino had their showdown, their big scene together. If you count the times that each actor on his own darts their eyes either to the left or to the right, and here we start, not looking at each other with direct eye contact, you will get drunk in about a minute and a half. Here we go. Each actor in their own turn looks to the right or looks to the left because the person opposite them is not worth their full attention. And it's, I'm more powerful than you. You don't have that much power to hold my entire focus. I'm going to show you how cool I am. I'll look off to the side. It's hysterical. Once you note this, watch it from one to the other.
Well,
Pacino, he's looked directly there. That's very... But De Niro, all the time. You're not important enough for my whole attention. I'm too cool for you.
Well, if it's a game they're playing, then that fits in what the game is. I mean, in a way, you could think of it this way, that if they're both animals, and when, you know, animals don't... You don't never want to look an animal straight in the eye, because then that triggers something instinctual, and they will be prepared to attack you.
Is that why you don't look me in the eye?
Exactly. So
to the side,
in the sense,
I'm going to actually name it each time it happens.
Part of it.
To the side.
One other thing, this was shot at Cape Mandalini's down in Beverly Hills off of Wilshire.
To the side. Cape Mandalini's.
Yeah. You have never, have you ever been Cape Mandalini's?
No, I haven't.
Oh,
to the side.
It's like, it's expensive diner food. Very nice decor. And you don't have to do it next time, Tim.
I'm sorry. Once you start noticing it, it's hysterical. Yeah. To the side. To the side. Okay, I'll stop.
Thank
to the
you.
Side. That's my last one.
I happen to think it's because they're, you know, I think it's part of what you're saying, but also...
It's a dance.
It's a dance, and also
dance.
They're thinking their way through this. And when you think, you tend to, for the most part, there's a tendency to dart your eyes, I think it's to the upper left.
Depends which side of the brain you're thinking with.
Okay, well then there you go. I mean, you tend to, if you're thinking, you go off and then you come back.
But isn't it also, psychologists or someone have said that if you do that, it's a showing that you're lying.
I think that's the right. No, I don't know. But when you're trying to retrieve information, sometimes your eyes may go in a different direction.
Up and to the left or up and to the right, yeah.
Okay, but it just escalates.
Well, but that's the thing.
After all this wah-wah, I will have to admit that I agree with Tim. It's two predators that don't want to put each other off by staring at each other and or showing too much teeth.
And that's fine. And you've got to allow to
keep each other at ease and just settle each other by not staring at each other, not...
You don't want to stare it down.
Yeah.
Right. You're playing it really cool. I'm giving you your space. I know what you can do, and you know what I can do. Well, I guess your point, Tim, is that maybe they took it a little too far. Is that...
Once you notice it, I don't notice anything else in the scene.
Oh, I mean, I've noticed it in that. I'm noticing the extra in the background, and she's talking very convincingly.
And the line of this scene is, "What are you, a monk?"
I do like that the fact that they know each other both by looking at each other. They can both size each other up pretty easily.
Right.
That's the big thing. And then later on, and what's interesting is really Michael Mann, if you take this scene from this scene to the end of the film, he could have went either direction with one or the other winning or losing in the end. And it would have worked.
Right.
Well, I love the scene for how it strips them down and they look at just who they are as people.
He could have had Pacino losing. He could have had...
I think it was the better choice, though, because you build Pacino up as the predator through the whole thing. And when he takes down Tom Sizemore, there's definitely that moment where you see his eyes and he's got that predatorial satisfaction. But when he takes down De Niro, it's like, he's just... hunting down one of his own kind, and there's more of the sympathy in the whole walking up and.
But when he does it because they're both hunting each other, and he takes him down. He doesn't shoot him once; he shoots him four times. I mean, he makes sure he.
Oh,
gets,
he's still a predator.
He gets him.
But you see this sort of sympathy for him after it's done.
Well,
But I mean, I agree with you. I think he made the right choice. But also at the end, that if De Niro would have won, it would have made sense for how efficient, how smart, how intelligent De Niro was if he chose to go that route.
Do you think?
No, I don't think it worked. Actually, I don't think that works because De Niro's sort of tragedy really, there's a moment when De Niro sort of decides his own fate.
He does, but right. that's the point where he could have chose one or the other story. Though.
Right, exactly, exactly, yeah. So when De Niro, when you have that scene later on, which is my favorite scene, without a line of dialogue.
When he just turns and goes back.
Yeah, and when he's in the car in the tunnel, and that's when he makes his choice, and that's when his destiny is decided.
Right, and then here they're just kind of establishing... Having a normal life, but basically they'll take each other out.
Going back to what Tim was doing, your drunk game, Tim, notice how here in now the last few lines of dialogue, they never took their eyes off each other. Right. When they both laid out, these are my cards, these are your cards. But now they're back.
But then he comes back.
But when they were both dead set on it.
And it means something when they
were
being
honest to each other. They were looking
right at each other's eyes. It means something when they do it. I agree, yes.
Yeah, now he's looking at that gaze hold. Yeah.
Right. And then, it's holding's like, I'll take you down. You know,
it's
that's
like
a flip side.
Layers of an onion. You just peel it away and peel it away, and now we're getting to pure. So they're looking directly
at
each
other. We've
also
been moving in closer and closer to the scene, too.
Yeah. It's nice. It all works.
And I think this is the making of, but I think they just did this in one take with like four to six different cameras shooting at once. I mean, they may have
done
it several times, and they let them go. There was no breaking it down.
I would. If I were the director, you had these two actors, I would let them go.
Yep. So you just play it all out, and you play it out several times,
they
and then you
it
have
one
it.
Take, but I think I heard Michael was saying that, or Michael Mann was saying that they shot it several times.
Right, they
pieced it together.
Yeah, exactly. The whole thing is they still had six cameras, and they let the whole scene run. They're breaking it down.
Yeah, that was a.
Oh, that's right. They dumped all the.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh, interesting focus right there. Mm-hmm. They lost it. They got it back.
Oh. And a TV behind them.
Now that you mention that, I mean, I've noticed it even more. They have to be on stage here because look how far back they are in every scene. I mean, the lenses, to be able to keep the focus that far
You can't
up,
be in tight space, yeah.
Yeah. I always love parking garage scenes.
Another drinking game might be Pacino and TVs that are in his shot. And that's what I think. There's a lot of different televisions that end up in the background with him.
I mean, this goes back to like me praising Michael Mann for the practicality. I mean, being a thief or being efficient and being good at what they do isn't like pretty work. It's not like an episode of CSI where it's like cool music playing over the background as you do your research. These guys are out there busting concrete. Earlier, whenever Val Kilmer was breaking into that door, he had that drill that was on like some sort of frame that was like bolted to the ground. they had to haul that crap in.
Look at this guy.
It was a big thing.
Terrified, hadn't slept in days. Hasn't left his office ever since that phone call.
Sleeping on the couch.
Yeah.
I like how the couch just has a sheet over it.
It's the meeting of the douchebags.
See, the lens on that is, and this one too, actually.
It's the only time we got anything in focus right there.
Yeah, background soft. He's sharp.
I do like that style.
Same thing here. I love it. I love it.
Like even there, look out. Look exactly. Look out of focus even.
It's moody. To me, it's just very moody. I love that style.
And this is where the story, the plot lines start converging.
This movie makes me very hungry. They either meet in kitchens or restaurants or nightclubs. And I hear the food frying right there.
Now, Bud Cort was in Harold and Maude.
Yeah.
And also he did Altman films back in the early 70s.
Altman films?
Did I say Robert Altman?
I heard Altman.
Yeah, Altman. Robert Altman films.
Robert Altman, yeah.
I think he did. Bud Cort was in MASH. That's why I thought of that. And he did a few other things. But, of course, Harold and Maude is the most famous film he's known for.
So at this time right now, Danny Trejo's already had the crap beat out of him. And
No, he's being tailed.
That's right.
What happens is after this, what happens is... When things go south in the bank robbery, it's because Wayne Groh gave the information and then whatever.
Yeah, well, already he has. That's how Trejo's got the tail.
Yeah, Van Zandt. Oh, okay. Oh, so it's not even the cops, it's other guys.
Yeah.
Another instance of calling a payphone.
Very interesting. That's right. And actually, it's interesting about the phone number. What they did in this is they did 105. Usually do 555 in movies. Here they just did 105 something. It's like, all right, well, you can do that. Payphones, alas.
Sharp foreground, soft background.
Yeah, I like this nice push-in. Very slow look. Matching both shots.
They match the speed.
Nice zoom push-in.
Oh, not here. Okay. It started to.
No, it still worked. A different take, but it worked well.
Looks great.
And then, of course, it just so happens that the guy, who's in the kitchen, does the same thing that they need.
It's one of the film tricks, but you let it pass in this moment.
That's the thing is Michael Mann made this work. Usually this thing does not work.
But that's the thing is, if you don't build that story before this means nothing, and it's like too coincidental that he's
right
there.
Right.
You know, if you don't allow for these few but pivotal scenes we've seen earlier with him, then the character means nothing, and then all this means nothing. So if he just walks up and says, "Hey, I know that guy," that's too simple.
President Palmer.
He's a big son of a bitch, too, because he's that far out of frame and offside. And he's look, he's leaning down right now. He's still taller than De Niro.
How are we going to do this? Just lean down against the fridge.
If you could squat, no, a little lower. Oh, that's a little lower.
That's just great. Everything's burning.
That is
everything's
funny.
Burning on the grill. He just throws it. He doesn't care.
What a waste of food.
And
I love the reaction of that background guy right there. That was excellent.
And she's packing. So she's like,
she's
bought into the idea of.
But I mean, she should pack to leave De Niro.
Well, no, she's packing to leave with him.
I know, but she should pack to leave him.
Well, of course, but she doesn't know yet. Oh, I remember those toys.
Here we
and
go.
Here's the
piece de resistance scene of the film.
The piece of resistance?
Piece of resistance. Passive resistance.
No, it's not passive.
That's oxymoron. Passive resistance. No, wait.
That was a nice little dolly. Hmm.
Yeah, passive resistance.
At ground level.
Nice. Again, great location work.
Yep.
Absolutely.
This was like all shot downtown somewhere.
Where the lights are bright.
Michael, where was it shot?
I don't know.
Can you tell?
Know.
That's downtown.
It's downtown. I'm just not sure specifically which building it is.
That's a nice shot of De Niro's eyes. And just the build-up to this is just great. Now, of course, if people walk into a bank and they have gloves on, wouldn't you be a little suspicious? I'm just saying.
And especially ski masks. That's very suspicious.
And when the ski masks
and when the guns come out, that's really suspicious. I felt that for all these heists, violent action scenes, that the background was very well done for the reactions you see of the people.
Yeah, no, I agree. The one scene
it has a realness to it.
The one scene I don't know is at the supermarket. I don't know. I guess, yeah. Yeah.
It's not so easy to do. And the background has this is happening kind of vibe.
Right.
I like the slow pace of the score right here. Just
here, I mean, plot-wise, what's happened is Van Zandt tipped off the cops. Someone tips off the cops.
That was very sensitive of him to address the crowd like that.
Just ripped his shirt right off.
Let it bleed. Okay, guy has a gun, says, where's, you know, give me the key. All right, whatever.
Well, I mean,
as you said, it's insured, but okay.
The sad part about this movie is that it did lead to the
I was going to ask about that.
In North Hollywood.
In North Hollywood.
The North Hollywood shootout, which was these guys mimicked what Val Kilmer and everybody and De Niro are doing right here, which is they loaded it for bear. They had fully automatic weapons, and they were had all their body armor on. That, which shows you how efficient Michael Mann is if you're going to pull off a bank heist, then you do it right. But these guys were a little more efficient, and it worked out a little better than those other people did.
Exactly.
And they actually figured it out, and they were still way smarter than them. I'm not seeing anybody go out and do a bank heist, but.
When did the
I'm not sure it actually did really work out anybody. I mean, most of guys.
No, everybody. Well, yeah, everybody here got caught eventually. Yes,
I mean, when did that bank heist happen here?
It happened like a couple years after.
Yeah, it was like late '90s, and because that was up on the Bank of America
on Laurel Canyon or something.
Laurel Canyon, like just north of Victory, and so they got away, and then they got caught later.
In the movie, in the actual...
No, in the actual robbery.
No, that they all died on the scene.
They died on the scene. Okay.
Well, I mean, a little tidbit nobody knows about is that the city of L.A. ended up paying out the family of one of the guys who was shot but still alive on scene, and the cops were just standing around letting him die. And
there was video
footage from a helicopter showing him there alive, but they weren't doing anything to resuscitate him or whatever, and he eventually ended up dying.
Wow.
But they had a payout, and the city of L.A. paid a lot of money.
That'll happen,
Which,
yeah.
To me, it's like, hey, mother... effer, you decided to rob the bank and shoot many people and do things.
But you still,
but the city of LA,
you still have to take. I mean, whatever. I mean, once you have them in custody, then you have a responsibility to take care of them in custody. And you know, I mean, there is. I know you can say, well, you can let them die, but.
Oh, Serge, you and I differ on so many points that I'm not.
I really like Christian Bale and Newsies.
Stop that!
Are you kidding me? You have a responsibility.
What? It's the law's the law. I mean, it, you know, it's not the law's not selective. I love this. I love this. How I mean, they're walking out here.
We're from
what?
Two different worlds.
What? That the law's the law. I think we're
talk
both,
about incredible.
Obviously, they broke the
we
law.
We both
that
live in the same country. I love how what is it? Was it? I mean, they keep on Val Kilmer. That's the whole thing. And they, you know, everyone like gets in the car. So Sizemore got in the car, and then De Niro gets in the car, and.
Michael, Serge and I, when I saw this with Serge a while back, we were wondering how much time was involved, would you say, in this location work?
I said like
week
2 weeks.
And a half.
Oh, wow.
With all lot. That we're seeing here for this one location.
Tons. But it,
what
it,
ballpark would you put it in?
It goes back, to, well,
a
couple
it's
weeks.
It's hard to weeks. Know. I mean, yeah, yeah, it's a lot of work. I mean, it depends how many days of shooting, too, that it took them and... But I mean, all this stuff is all controlled. So you're blocking off at least mm-hmm. what like 3 blocks here.
Yeah.
So what you don't see is barricades and police down further down, and you know, these are all crosses right here. There's no way you could let traffic flow on a shot where you got guys running around with guns. So this yeah. is all controlled.
And so all these cars are stunt cars. And all these actors are stunt actors. I mean,
here comes up, and then he just sees them, yep. and he just starts shooting.
Just doesn't even flinch, yeah.
Well, that's the thing. It's like he's ready to get away, but he sees them, he goes. In that sense, he's really well... I mean, the idea is that he's really well trained.
Yeah. Well, I heard on one of the commentaries to this, and it's a good point to make. That,
there goes Ted Levine.
Yeah,
good death.
Yep. And just
he
dead
did that
like
very
that.
Well.
Oh, yeah.
But so what happened
I mean, it's
is
unglamorous. That's the whole thing. It's
Val
just,
Kilmer
boom.
Was saying one time that he talked to a guy that was in the military, and this whoever it was that was trained in basic training or wherever, whenever he was getting his tactical training, when they first started, they showed him a video, and they showed him the video of this shootout, and they showed Val Kilmer doing the scene you're going to see here in a few minutes where he shoots over a truck, and he empties the clip. Loads the clip, turns around, goes the other way,
right.
and he goes back and forth, and then they showed that to the military people that they were training
wow.
and said, right. that's how you shoot in a firefight, and this is how you do this. And that goes back to what I said earlier. All of this was shown, all these actors that you're seeing right now shooting all this weaponry and all this heavy gear,
oh, like
not
the,
only
I like
were
the
they
spattering.
Trained with fully automatic weapons mm-hmm. with live fire. Now, right here, normally this the actual thing that the stunt
Toronto.
People would do, these stunt people would actually, or these weapons would have half loads or quarter loads, just enough to kick out bullets,
right.
just to show that the bullets are flying out. Yeah, it's right here.
Yeah.
But what you would do, they did here, was they had full loads on everything that they shot throughout this all these scenes.
So they were yeah. shooting live rounds?
They're not shooting live rounds. They're shooting full loads, which means the exact same amount of gunpowder you would have
oh, okay.
in a full
got
load.
It. All right.
So
there you go.
It's, right here. This
yeah.
is the scene.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, they must have been doing notifications for weeks and weeks before this, because you would have the entire neighborhood would have
That's,
needed to know that, you know.
It's a major artery.
Yeah.
But that helped out Michael Mann in the post-production of this, because what happened in post-production with the sound was he... There's the scene right here.
Yeah. Well, he does it several
and now
times.
Watch,
yeah.
he'll come down one scene or one shot.
And then do it again.
Reload, pop back up. Okay. And that's the scene. But anyway, so what happened in post-production when they were doing the sound on this is they were going to loop the sound. They were going to go back in and put in special effects sound.
This is
and
location sound?
This is all location sound.
Oh, you're
and
kidding
what they
me.
Did
wow.
is they couldn't mimic the echo off the buildings
oh, wow.
and all of that. So the fact that he used full loads paid off in the end.
Because they had the same
sound. We'll talk about notifications yeah. weeks in advance. You're going to be hearing gunfire.
Yeah.
I mean.
Exactly. Live gun.
No,
yeah, well.
They did that. They did that. And then the story
well,
goes
to, yeah.
that even during the filming of this, there were still people doing 911 calls
of course.
On a daily basis.
Of course.
All of these scenes.
As
so
they
now,
should.
Unbelievable.
So now, of course, the really evil thing to do would be is if you knew a shoot like this was going on.
To plan your own.
To plan your own bank robbery mm-hmm, during this
at
time.
At the same time.
Yeah.
Yikes. Interesting. So security,
oh,
how's that handled
oh,
when you're
man.
In production so that doesn't happen?
You're talking about a lot of logistics.
Yeah, this is a big shoot right here.
And this is also, I think, a payoff for Michael Mann whenever you when you allow for that type of, you know,
West Duty shot Val Kilmer.
You just go ahead and you allow these actors, you shoot these full loads. Notice how they're leaning into the gun. And if it's anybody that's ever shot a gun in their life, you don't just sit there and shoot 85 rounds with a semi-automatic pistol and it doesn't kick out of your hand. If they've ever shot a 45 or 9mm even, it kicks. So when they're leaning into those guns like that, they're leaning into it so the gun doesn't trail up and go out of frame.
Right, yeah.
Very well storyboarded for what's happening when and where, that whole sequence. You know, yeah. All made perfect sense.
And it's just so explosive. Like, from the very minute Val Kilmer just starts that whole shoot, it's just bam.
Oh, yeah.
What I love is all the character work that's come before this. So the payoff is just huge for knowing each person that's involved. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Well, I mean, you know, that's interesting because the shootout, I mean, in a way, it's an abstraction. It is its own thing. You know, it's guys robbing a bank. You know them. You're kind of rooting for them, strangely enough. But it exists all, you know, it's in a different world than everything we've seen before from them. It's not out of incongruous, but it is. It's like its own thing. And that's, I mean, in a way, I mean, if you notice, I mean, the sound mix is really hot on this. It's really, I mean, that gun... The gunfire just overtakes everything.
It's really
which is exactly
what it
should, and it gives it
shocking,
and to the point where everything is out. You know, I'm not living. This is all. It's all fear. I mean, it's all adrenaline. It's all action.
Yeah, this has got you right where it wants you as an audience.
Absolutely.
This,
now, I just want to point out something. Watch the shot when actually Pacino shoots Sizemore's character. And they actually put a cut in there.
Yeah, this is actually Pacino's big predatorial moment coming up. You really see him as a predator.
Of course, this guy takes a kid. Bad move. Never take the kid.
Well, we've got to lose all sympathy for him at this point.
Oh, we totally lost all sympathy for him.
So we can be happy that he died.
And that's why I thought it was a little pushing it a bit. And of course, you have the music coming up too. And of course, all he does is he waits for him. Now watch Pacino's shot. Turns and there was a cut in there.
Within that shot?
Within that shot, there was a cut.
See that face? There it is, the predator.
Yep, exactly. Within that shot, when he pulled the trigger,
it was like a jump cut.
It was like a bit of a jump cut, which I'd never noticed before. Hmm.
Yep. Gives it more impact.
I was like, wow, how do you even think of that? Maybe it was an accident. Yeah, take the kid away from the guy. I'm like, oh, my God. Paul Moyer.
He looks the same today.
Now usually in films, the use of TV, like, no one can seem to make it work. Oh, I see a TV report. This is, like, one of the few films I think makes it work, and it just feels completely natural and within that, you know, believable.
This is a big payoff for this woman right here.
Yeah.
Emotionally, I really feel what she's going through when she sees this.
Yeah, this is like her
terrible.
It's like her third scene.
Yeah.
And that's it. And she knows exactly what happened.
Oof.
And look who it is.
It's Piven.
Before he gets his hair plugs.
Yeah, he's allowed. He's an actor. Well, that's a nice moving off of the, whatever the machine's called.
It's an autoclave.
Autoclave?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's a really interesting choice because he's basically a comedic actor.
At this time, he was just an actor. I think the only thing I knew him from at this time was One Crazy Summer, Demi Moore.
Oh, man, that's right.
John Cusack.
When was he was on the Ellen show, wasn't he? Ellen DeGeneres' first sitcom.
Oh, wow.
Look at the back hair on Piven. He's had a lot of doctoring done. Maybe it was just a transplant.
Yikes.
I'd hate to hear how he talks about you.
Nobody talks about me.
Oh, then there you go.
Nobody talks about me.
You know, Val Kilmer plays sick very well.
Drugged up and sick.
You know, he did great for Doc Holliday. He does great. He just he's able to get that look in his eye, like, oh my God.
He was great as Morrison in Number of Drugs.
Doors, yeah.
Maybe he's not acting.
He was good in Real Genius.
All the wrap-up scenes?
Yeah.
Handheld.
Very well done. This is up in the hills, I think.
So this is where we find out what happened.
Yeah. The gruesome touches, the blood on the wall.
Mm-hmm. Splattered.
See that? I think basically Wengro went over and did this.
I think the gruesome touch is the exploded head right here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the makeup on Danny Trejo.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
It was Wengro, yeah.
It's an old school Western scene. He's going to kill him for him, put him down for him.
Yep.
Ooh, rack focus.
I know.
Interesting.
Didn't see that. Yeah. That's really interesting.
Why, yeah. Take the attention off the gun, go to the city.
And then
show the city looking at the house.
And then just show the flash from outside.
Soft background, sharp forehead. I love it.
I like how he's drinking a glass of wine.
Do we have a favorite John Voight film?
Ooh, that's tough.
Deliverance?
Runaway Train.
Oh, Runaway Train's a good one.
Speaking of Danny Trejo.
Midnight Cowboy's pretty awesome.
Never seen that.
You've never seen Midnight Cowboy?
Never seen Midnight Cowboy.
Wow, that's one you need to check out. It's an incredible film.
Mm-hmm. That was the only film to ever win Academy Award that was X-rated.
That's right.
Well, it was X-rated at the time. They have the same rating now.
It was quite controversial.
Yeah. And it had the X rating at the time for... Why did it?
X rating for graphic, sexual, adult theme, sleazy stuff for the time.
Just for the theme, or did you actually see stuff.
No, I was more. No, you didn't see. Well, a couple of. It wasn't to by today's standards.
It'd
nothing.
Be just be an R. Okay, that's what I was.
For 69, I came out 69. Right, it was huge as far as the graphic sexual stuff. That was considered obscene.
That was like Carnal Knowledge was around that time too, which had a whole Supreme Court case with it and stuff like that, which I think they won. This is great. It's like, once again, you can't just bust a door down. He's got to blow off the hinges. Yeah,
exactly.
That's great. And the charges were, I mean, charges were really good. You couldn't tell that the gun wasn't shot.
Stunt double
didn't
the whole time.
Yeah. Oh, that's Henry Rollins right there.
It's Henry Rollins, big scene.
Oh, yeah. Now, notice he grabs him the same way that De Niro grabbed Wangro.
Interesting.
In that earlier scene, yeah.
Very noirish.
Okay, if this is Encino, is that the Valley? No, that's Hollywood, right? That's Hollywood in the background. That should
might be Studio City too.
Should have been the Valley. Well, no, he said.
Ooh,
it was,
I just saw the camera crew. The reflection.
Oh man,
the
guys were walking.
Oh, damn it!
Guys were walking. They were hustling too. They were really booking.
It's like, get out now. No, he said this was. He said this was Encino hockey. Yeah.
And another broken glass.
Yeah.
Oh, he had a very thick chest. If you look at his chest in that, that was pretty thick.
Yeah.
Damn safety crews.
Yeah.
Making those squibs not be on the real skin.
It's all right.
Ruins the whole movie for me.
It takes me
out of it completely.
That's why I've never seen another gunshot scene as good as the one
I like how she's walking down and she... Where is it here? It's just catch. She looks and, oh, there's just a couple of cops standing.
Drinking coffee.
Drinking coffee. It's not like she walks in and they're waiting for her. It's just oh so casual.
And what's with Hank Azaria's bag?
It's her bag.
I know, I'm kidding.
Okay, it's his bag.
Interesting joke. Character choice.
A joke over Serge's head.
Oh, please.
Ooh. I like how he's got the respect. He's always got that. Have you noticed that this whole movie? He's had that little swagger when he walks. He's got his hands pointed backwards, palms of his hands.
Hmm. Well, this is actually. I mean, what's nice is that this is his sequence. This whole thing. Now
it's his
chance to be his set of scenes with that Al Pacino.
I wonder if there was. I wonder what the original first cut, how long that ran. Because, I mean, the length of this thing for
Michael
a theatrical
Mann,
feature.
Yeah,
what's yeah, exactly. It's 170 minutes. But I think I remember reading at some point there definitely were a lot of things that got trimmed out, and clearly some of the stuff with Ashley Judd and Val Kilmer got cut back.
Oh, I don't doubt. I mean, it's like any of those films, Apocalypse Now, or any of those ones that are, there's so much more to that, you just got to, I mean, I haven't seen the redux of Apocalypse Now, but I haven't heard a lot of great things about it.
It was all right. You know, honestly, the scenes they added in, I could have done without.
Exactly. That's kind of the point.
It's like, is interesting. Oh, wow. But I don't think it added that much that really, because I think the original film worked great. In fact, I think the film, the scene, strangely enough, off topic, with the where they're talking with the French people.
Love that shot.
Mm-hmm. Really doesn't work. Henry Rollins.
Yeah. Once again, look how far back soft they
focus.
Must be.
Oh, yeah.
That soft a focus of those lights in the back.
But look at the lens also, because you have the curvature. It's just, I mean, I know it's not natural, but it works great photographically.
Eye candy. Works for me.
Yeah, it works for me.
I love the wind. I can feel the night. I can feel that night air. It's great.
Very noir.
I think that shot might have to be a green screen shot.
You think?
Do you think? If it was, they made it work really well. I don't know.
I think it's a beautiful green screen shot if it is.
No, I think they actually did it. I don't know. It looks like they could have.
Never knew.
I'd be very impressed if that were a green screen shot.
And so now we have our ticking clock. 7 or 8 hours, and Neil is gone. Okay, now come the fireworks.
I'm waiting for her big jacks that are on the... Where'd it go,
they
Curtis?
They removed him, man. Come on.
Where did
You're
it
the
go?
Continuity guy. You tell me.
I don't see it.
Now, not to get picky, how did she figure out that this is what he did?
It would have blocked De Niro, so they removed it.
Oh, they took it down. No, there's the jacks on the counter.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but why are they there? They were up in the bookshelf.
Because she's moving stuff around because she was packing stuff.
God damn it, Serge.
What?
Boy, that sun came up quick.
It's a nice sunrise. I like the light that's falling on them. Very nice, soft light. It's probably what, Michael, on a 40 by grid,
women's intuition.
With silk.
It'll never pay off for us.
Hanging over them.
They're being hit with some kind of serious
light.
There's definitely
some HMIs going here.
Another,
but only on the
focus
grass,
shift.
Yes.
I love the old monitor.
More TVs.
Hey, that was high tech then.
Hey, let me tell you.
Yeah, but it's with De Niro. There's no.
Yeah, that's true. It's not.
Where's
a Pacino?
Pacino?
Yeah. Pacino has his big TV moments coming up.
Yes, there's nothing subtle about Pacino's TV moments coming up.
No.
And her reaction to all this, I find interesting.
Yeah.
In what way? Elaborate, please.
Just that she goes with it, and it's like, oh, I'll think it through, and yeah, okay, la, la, la.
She's really disgusted, but at the same time, she still decides to go with him.
But do you buy that? Why she decides to go with him?
Not really. I thought she had it more together than that.
That's great. That was awesome what she just did.
Especially from
his
actions
great
right
when
here.
She just, like, he went to kiss her, and she said, that's subtle.
I just thought she was more together than that.
Look at that. It's incredible.
And I'm severely disappointed that she doesn't continue with her convictions that you're seeing here.
Look at that L.A. City shot. Mm-hmm. Where are they at from here?
Hills. Yeah.
Yeah, Hollywood Hills look like.
More food. Man, I'm starving.
Look at Pacino.
You know, he's like, oh.
Pacino's like, I've had quite a day.
There's Xander Berkeley, who played Wayne Grohl in L.A. Takedown.
What's interesting is right here how she's just so blasé, like, ready.
And he's like, I'm going to go. No, you stay. Where is it?
Yeah, this is
interesting. Like, sit down. Yeah.
He was the man that was stabbed in the face in Terminator 2 that was John Connor's stepfather.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's
adopted
right.
Father.
Oh, that's right. And Jeanette Goldstein, who was in Aliens, played the mother.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she played...
That stabbed him in the face.
In Aliens, what was her name? And she was... what was her name, Curtis, in Aliens? Yes. Come on.
You're trapping me now.
Yes.
Damn. Nah, it's bugging me.
And she was with that guy. Her last scene was, what's his name? Borman or something. Borman, you always were an asshole.
Yeah.
Or something there in the tunnel.
Borman, you pull out Borman and you can't think of her name.
Well, yeah. I don't know if it's Borman.
There's the TV, man. There's the TV.
Ooh, and we just saw a light umbrella in the reflection of the TV.
Oh, very good.
Tim.
Wow, you're really looking there, aren't you?
I'm not. It pops out sometimes. I'm looking at the reflections. That's like that picture in the back. You
stop
just
looking at
let
the
your
reflections.
Eye look off to the side in reflections, and you're bound to find something. That's how it works.
He tries to leave again. It's like...
Because he's got a great big ass.
I love how she
stuck up it.
This shows you how bitchy women can be. She's doing this is just
what?
Look at her go. She's doing it.
She has no cause. She has.
I don't care that your job sucks. I don't care, but I just want a little dick.
Right. Okay. All right, Curtis.
What? Hey,
women and their games.
Oh yes, because all women are alike.
Finally, we agree upon something, Serge.
Yeah, I was being sarcastic, monsieur. But she did a great job there. I mean, she played her game.
End of a rope.
Him. Jumpy much? That's a great plan, by the way. It's amazing they can, like, they piece it all together. This is how, you know, they have this thing. Now, this is where likely they cut stuff out because we didn't see any of the, you know, Val Kilmer stuff with him. All he does is he tells him what's going on. We don't actually see it. Not that we really needed to, but still. Show, don't tell.
And of course, guys in John Voight's position always have to own
a bar. Yeah.
Look at the light on that tree.
I was going to say, nice. Bam.
Surprisingly bright tree.
One heck of a garden light on that tree.
That's nice, though. Look at that. This is
very nice.
This is Spinotti right here.
Yeah, that's. Look at the temperature on their faces. Oh,
very
the light
nice.
There. That's
very nice.
Very good. Lit the fence in the background to pop.
Well, I mean,
soft focus back there.
I mean, think about how they got her and him lit.
And they didn't light the hill, which is interesting.
Yeah, but I love the silhouette of the back hill.
Road.
That's great.
Right.
And so I can the cool temperature of the sky there.
And the time that they had to shoot this, which was, I'm guessing this is, once again, pre-dawn. So that means you've got a window like an hour.
Before the light starts hitting.
Yeah. I mean, you're booking.
And she's how dark her jacket is.
And it's all
so
separated.
So her skin pops against that.
And this isn't even Blu-ray.
Nope. That has a very noir feel to it.
Yep.
That shot. And I love it how they're screen right. And you have all that space to the left.
They're all tucked screen right. Oh, I love that.
And
absolutely.
How they got him kind of hidden behind
tucked
her.
Behind her.
Yeah, just like barely. So you got him like three quarters of his face. And
so you're looking at her but listening to him.
Yep.
Oh, I wish she hadn't moved. That was a really nice.
But now she's.
Size wanted to enjoy that some more. I'm just greedy.
And now she's listening, and now she's going to. She'll go with him. This is great music once again. Elliot Goldenthal did an awesome job.
Look at that.
I mean, this
it's
really created
light.
Its own sense of a modern noir film.
Like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think anyone's ever really,
about, yeah.
You know, anyone's really been able to reproduce, I think.
I would love a resurgence of noir.
Yeah, I mean,
I would love that.
You had Blade Runner that did something mm-hmm. with, it,
oh,
did with the genre, and then this.
It's because it's so cinematic. I just love that.
I like the dolly around.
Camera's moving everywhere.
Oh, yeah.
All shots right now.
Yep.
And I do like this moment of Ashley Judd right here, this where she allows him to go.
Yeah.
The little finger.
Mm-hmm.
Moment
the little
there.
Hand gesture.
Yeah, a little hand gesture there.
Yeah.
Just, nope.
Subtle. Yeah. Well, that's a good question. I mean, do you think they ever find out that you do that? I love how the lights and just the composition of all this. You have the lights point to her back.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, did she get away with it? Chris makes his way off in life, and everything's cool, and he never showed up.
Well, I think he does, but I think they know. I think that he knows.
They can't peg anything on her.
I mean, right.
She gets off.
Because I want Ashley Judd to go free.
Nice rim light from that backlight.
A very good one.
Now, whether she goes free or not, that's a whole different story.
Well, that's kind of my question. I like how they pan across so they can go around, and then there he is. I mean, I guess, yeah.
It's a good shot. This is a great shot. Look at this. It continues right over to here.
Nice.
It's not a crane.
Technicrane, yeah. It'd be Technicrane.
Very good shot.
The only thing that bothers me about this scene is I still don't buy that Val Kilmer just rolls away based on, you know, a fake license. It's like,
yeah,
this isn't the guy.
I agree with you, yeah.
But they had to get him away somehow. As
5RQ.
I'll agree with that. I agree with that.
Yeah. Vasquez!
Vasquez! Thank you. That was the character name in Aliens. Of the woman. See, it all comes around, fellas.
Yes.
Thank you, Curtis. Yes. I feel so much better.
That's right. Now that we know genetics.
It's been gnawing at me ever
since. Look at Val slipping back to ice territory with that haircut.
That's right. And see, he plays sick very well. And he's
in the danger zone.
Really hurting. And look at that.
That's a good shot. That's nice.
Man, look
at
that.
See, the one thing I don't buy is that.
150 yards away with a telephoto.
I mean, cinematically here, I mean, that's like this, like the one like inflation of a moment where we understand what's going on, but realistically, that would have happened in like within a second, not the whatever 10, 15 seconds we saw.
She looks angelic there. Look at that.
Ashley Judd.
Looking down from heaven.
She always looks angelic.
Aw.
With the music behind her.
Yeah, this DP is wonderful. For the second time watching this movie, I'm really appreciating his work.
Yeah, he's phenomenal.
Yeah.
Go back and watch Last of the Mohicans and see what he does with natural landscapes. It's pretty amazing, too. Mm-hmm.
In what?
Last of the Mohicans.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I saw that in the theater. I remember it was very well shot.
Those are stop signs in perfect focus. One way.
It's a little soft. It kept them moving, actually. What? They were following the focus.
The tension as we wait to find out.
Yeah, yeah. She looks calm.
Yeah, he looks exactly like the guy who's got shorter hair, but his license, it says he's somebody different. We got to let him
license
go.
Says he's Michael. License says he's Michael Smith. What kind of name is that?
Let him go.
I'm sure. Leaving.
Well, you know, crazier things have happened in life.
Well, true.
Sure, sure.
It was 95. Sure. They didn't have, you know, well, they had the internet, but.
But only Al Gore was using it then.
Right. It was just Al Gore himself.
Move in.
Her best scene by far.
Pretty good.
Yeah, that was nice. It was understated right there. That's good.
As opposed to this, earlier on in the film, she's a little over the top for me, but right there. She's
really, that was understated. That was something was happening internally. That was nice.
So I think Val's the only one who gets away, right? Everybody else?
Yeah. Meets their demise.
Mm-hmm.
That almost looks like a diopter. Because of the difference in focus there.
There.
But I do love the moment where De Niro does get Wangro back. It's pretty good stuff.
Yeah.
It's good stuff.
It fits.
Well, you can't leave. I mean, number one rule of these kinds of films, you can't leave a douchebag alive.
TV
has
you
to
have
go.
To kill
TV
kill.
Sets to the right.
There you go.
Yeah. Oh, he's surrounded by TVs.
Bam! I mean, I never noticed it before, and I've seen this film several times. It's like, why the fully concrete room with just the holes?
It sure looks nice.
Oh, I mean,
it looks
awesome.
Great. It's photographed.
And
so
these
amazing.
Lights above there. That's a fortress.
Which I guess that's the answer I just answered.
Oh, it's very easily lit. You go and you shoot. Everything's well well lit right from the get go, and it's not totally flat, but it's very compelling visually. I like the sliding door too. Very future.
He's on the bridge of the Enterprise.
Exactly. Him and his TV.
Just, that's what it's down to.
He's probably got him strapped in. He loves that TV.
Doesn't have any.
No, it moved.
Funny thing is, he doesn't have anything left but the hunt and the TV, and shortly he gets rid of the TV.
Look at the outside of the building that we saw the inside of.
Exactly. Yeah, we see with the little windows. Exactly. The windows, have the basically that same, well, theme repeating also that. Yeah.
Look at that night right there. That's great. Look at that. That looks really
nice.
Here we go.
Is this it?
Lady runs across. Nice ADing. And he's chewing gum again. Oh. I want to know how many takes that took and how many TVs that took.
So that's it. All he's got left now is going after De Niro.
Well, he's given up on that. Because he said he's gone and he doesn't even notice this. So now this is basically, TV. I mean, essentially this is the beginning of the third act. Everything's gone. You know, Neil McCauley's made his escape. They've lost, you know, track of everything.
So here, with nothing left in his life now, here we have the that surrogate suicide. Yeah, I never thought of it that way, but...
Yeah. I don't think that was a green screen shot. That's actually at the hotel, though, at the round hotel that's right off the 405 on Sunset.
Oh, it's a Holiday Inn, isn't it?
It was a Holiday Inn. It's not anymore. But at the time, I think it was a Holiday Inn, and it was looking out on the city. Looking east, and here we go. Act three begins.
Probably the most amount of she went to the leg too.
Yeah, she
went through. That's probably the most amount of color we've seen in the whole movie. Mm-hmm. Was that shot looking down with the blood?
Yeah, and the use of red, of course. Well, literally.
Do you think they saturated this film at all in post?
Yeah, look at that. She wasn't playing around either.
I think with some stuff, yeah.
You mean as far as tints, colors,
like knocked them down some?
Days way before digital intermediate, but I'm sure that they corrected things.
And they spent a lot of time on this, too.
I'm glad they did.
No, I am, too. It's just really interesting they do. Here's the only other part that bugs me. This is fine when she says that, and then she sees the car pull in, which is great.
He had good parking.
And then she goes on with this. I think they could have lost that shot.
Well, she didn't know it was him until just now.
And they could have tightened that shot. That's like the only shot I have a quibble with.
The only one?
The only one. This is a perfect film otherwise for me. Except for Henry Rollins.
Was the actress Amy Brenneman, what's her name?
Amy Brenneman, yes.
Was she on ER?
She was on NYPD Blue.
Oh, NYPD Blue, okay.
First season. Which at the time when NYPD Blue came out was way, very innovative, just different than anyone had seen. I like how he came in and told them, you know, everything, what to do.
And I wonder if this guy's an actual doctor.
Get a vascular surgeon, blah, blah, blah.
No, Michael Mann, probably.
No, likely.
You know, and just went through the paces of what to do.
Yeah, he doesn't really have an actor's voice. I mean,
he sounds good, who's an actor. But yeah. He struck me as someone who's actually was a doctor that was put into the project.
That's what I was saying. The guy who was in Vegas with Hank Azaria, I think that was probably, he looked like he was just a cop, you know, who just looks good on screen, doesn't have to say very much.
Those are good touches to do if you can, if the person's good enough to put into a film.
Yeah, see, that guy just did the cross with the flowers. Actor, totally. That chick right there, that nurse, that's not an actor.
No, well, I mean, what movie was it?
You just didn't buy the way he was carrying the flowers.
I didn't. The way
it was Bullet. Upright. Bullet with Steve McQueen.
Right.
They used real
nurses and real doctors for the scene.
Well, I mean, a lot. I mean, Burt Reynolds
and
was
E.T. Spielberg
for...
used real doctors and crew, medical crew for
sure.
The scene where E.T. died.
True.
It's good to do in medical scenes if you can get away with it.
Oh yeah,
to make them play so much better.
I think like I'm trying to think. I think it was maybe X-Files would work with X-Military.
Oh, here we go.
X-Military.
Here we go.
This is the scene.
Coming
this is
up
your
to
scene.
My favorite scene.
Look, awesome shot.
That's great how they're lit within the car. Yeah. But that goes back to, remember, when the cop car towards the beginning, even that they had it lit from within, so it drew your eye, even just as an element in the background.
But it doesn't look lit.
Okay,
which is
so that's the whole thing. You,
he's
you
finding out where
it.
Wayne Grove is right now is our sort of key thing right here.
And I like the flares also. Look at the flares.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's those are awesome.
That's good.
And they're real flares.
Almost looks like the bridge of the Enterprise in the last Star
Trek
movie.
No, don't even get me started. They're real flares, not faux flares.
Faux flare.
So now he's got all the information, and he could just go
right.
off.
Right. Here's where he's got to make the choice.
If Voight would have never called him.
Exactly.
God dang it.
And you see in Voight's performance there that he doesn't really want to tell him.
Yeah.
But he sort of can't not tell him.
Well, yeah, exactly. He can't because it is, I mean, he's got to take, that's a great shot. And they're
here
going
we go.
Through the tunnel.
And here's decision time. Watch his face through this scene right
Look
here. It's
at
just
this.
Amazing.
Does that tunnel and all that light represent the...
Tunnel of knowledge?
Catharsis or something that happens?
And look, and look, she's like, she had an angelic quality there.
Yeah. Watch for the moment when he makes
a choice.
Now
they're back in darkness.
This is the thing. Watch for the moment when he makes a choice.
Yeah. It's like he's almost crying or something. He's like, he's... Boom!
It was what happened was there. He does a little bit of a smile, like
sure,
you know,
sure.
He's yeah. like, I know I'm making the wrong choice, but it's what I have to do.
So did that the light in the tunnel? Did that represent the bridge of what can never
passing
be?
Over.
I think
yeah,
it's sort of
passing.
It's,
yeah.
I think it's sort
to
of
me,
a limbo
visually.
Space. I think it's a limbo space there where it's you know he's in between two different you know
worlds?
Paths that he could take, mm-hmm. and then
I love that
yeah.
Or, I mean, I was looking at it that basically, you know, at that moment he's like got happiness, he's got enlightenment, everything's going to work out fine, and then they pass out of the tunnel, and then he's got the darkness, and now he's, you know, the dark thoughts have come back again.
Well, it's kind of with that smile, it's like he knows, there's that self-awareness right there, he knows who he is, and he knows he can't make any other choice but to do what he's going to do.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly, exactly. It
Destiny.
Is his nature. Well, in a way, it is his nature, he's an animal.
Exactly.
He knows his nature, and now we're back to the beginning, because remember the beginning, he went into whatever place that he went into and just fit right in, acted like he belonged.
See, that's what I love about this scene right here, is it seems like, to me, more than any other scene, you could see how smart and intelligent he is to just off the cuff improvisation, just come in here and just zip and get exactly what he wants with no planning, because he's so efficient, he's so thorough, even with no laid out plan, he's more efficient than you or I ever could be.
And in a way, the whole movie has been a setup for now this sequence and how he does this, because we've now learned what he does and how he can do it, and how he's always planned and how he can then basically take this, and we accept, okay.
Yeah, I never noticed that before, Sergio, but you're right. It is coming back around at the beginning. They even kind of squared up his shoulders in that behind shot, following him just like they did into the hospital in the beginning. So, it's interesting.
I nice touch.
Yeah.
I guess it's the, I don't want to say corollary to, you know, the whole thing of all third act problems are first act problems. I'd say all third act non-problems, things that work, are well planted in the first act.
So why'd she do that with her hands?
Because she feels like something's wrong. Her palms are getting sweaty.
Early onset of osteoporosis.
She knows, and he sees the gun. He sees the gun right there. Oh, I love that. He's awesome in this film. Because the thing is, you're so on his side.
Yeah. In a way, there's some aspects of the scene that are not plausible, but he just manages to make it feel plausible.
Yeah.
And I just love how much in this film it's told with the camera. There's so many great sequences that are just pure cinema because it's all camera.
Show, don't tell.
Well, I mean, even here, look how out of focus everybody else is. And just...
It just keeps the focus... Well, it keeps all the focus on him. We know... You know,
it's been the consistent style of this film to be that way. It's nice.
Subconsciously, yeah. I mean, because something it's not something you usually notice, because usually you might try and tend to keep the background in focus, possibly. But Now, okay, the other quibble I have here, now it's more quibble from now.
You already said you only had one.
That's right. You only get one.
yeah, new rules. Anyway, normally in hotels now, so the thing is if you shot it now, normally in hotels you have cameras all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, he wouldn't be able to get away with the same type of thing, or I guess he'd do it differently.
1985?
Yeah.
Well, the thing here is, though, too, he just for the same reason that smile works, he knows.
Yeah.
Pacino and a TV behind him.
There you go. And a wheelchair, an open wheelchair. What's that saying? Yeah, basically it is. She chose him.
Mm-hmm. Because they're sort of same in a lot of ways.
There's that beeper again.
Chewing that gum.
Even when he's sitting, he's still moving.
It's a lot of Pacino's work I haven't seen. I haven't seen Dog Day Afternoon.
Oh, yeah.
Doggy.
Classic.
I haven't. What else of his?
Serpico is another great one.
Yeah, I haven't not seen that.
His early 70s stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Serpico with Sidney Lumet, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But you've seen The Godfathers, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so. What else did he do? He did that. I don't know. Blanked.
Come on, man. Cruising. Let's talk.
I haven't seen
Cruisin'?
That.
Cruising?
That is one freaking.
I had a friend who watched that recently.
Frankie and Johnny.
Oh yeah, I guess that's going into the '80s. But I mean, his work is almost.
I haven't seen Scent of a Woman.
Always quality work.
Dick Tracy.
I actually really like him in Dick Tracy.
Dick Tracy has its charm, absolutely. Warren Beatty's great as Dick Tracy.
Scent of a Woman, you need to watch just for his final monologue.
Oh, what was the
Devil's Advocate?
I was going to say that.
Keanu
Reeves.
As the devil. Oh, he had a blast doing that. But that's like once again his 90s films. That's part of, you know.
Yeah,
this
I have
part
a theory that all great actors have to play the devil at some point in their career.
Okay,
it's like a requirement.
So who else has played? Oh, see, and now he's like running off.
Think
excited.
Of a great actor, and you'll at some point in their career they have played.
Charlton Heston.
Jack Nicholson played the devil.
Jack Nicholson.
Charlton Heston did not play the devil.
He said a great actor.
Laurence Olivier should have played.
Great actor. Oh. Them's major fighting words.
Well, he's not played the devil.
He hasn't played the devil. Well, actually, no, I take that back. He played a villain. He played Cardinal Richelieu.
Look how all the signs are in focus.
That's a nice choice.
Well, Charlton Heston hadn't died yet, has he? He still has a chance.
Charlton Heston died.
Charlton Heston passed away.
Oh, yeah. He hasn't acted for all this decade. He had Alzheimer's and then he just passed away.
I missed out on
that. About a year or two ago.
Nice.
And the guy's got his head turned. Okay, now here, does Wango suspect something?
Of course. That's why they just did what he did.
I know, but... You'd think still.
Nice.
No, it's awesome. Oh, no, that's what that was for. Ooh,
ooh.
Nice. Yeah. Kind of handheld.
Handheld.
That was the gun-held shot.
Handheld violence.
This is a great death, too, where he breathes in.
And but he tells him, hey, look at me.
No, I mean, whenever he shoots him.
Oh.
Like whenever he sucks in after he shoots him.
Oh, that was an interesting cut there.
Yeah, that was gross.
Yeah.
It works because it was
gross.
I mean,
it would take your breath away.
Yeah, literally, it would take a lot away. Your breath, your life, and
is that
it takes
my lung
everything.
That just collapsed?
But the bad
this
guy.
This is a wonderful sequence. Look at her. I love this.
And once again, it goes back to the pump. She like she knows. It's like she's an animal. Once again, she knows something's wrong. Oh. This is great. And he just backs. It's like.
Ow.
He knows his shit.
That's just rude.
Ouch.
Kicks the gun away. Oh, look at that.
House creeping.
There's something sort of Christ-like in that shot.
But it's
the
like,
realization in her right now.
Oh, yeah.
So good.
She just,
and I love when he just
passes her by.
Notice how when she's looking around, everybody's out of focus and still. I can dig it.
It's the helicopter again.
See, Serge, in your world, Wangro would have lived.
How would he have lived?
Well, but
in my world,
you protect those people.
If he had been in police custody,
he was in police custody, and De Niro just killed him. That is just horribly wrong.
Yeah,
the city should pay them $40 million.
You see, now you're warping the argument to make a non-argument.
Oh, and the hunt's back on.
Wait a minute.
All the background stuff
I've been
in this movie. Man.
I've been to that
this.
Hotel. I just recognized it. It's down by the air. Okay. I know what hotel that is.
You got all the outfits of all the hotel staff. You got all the medical.
Oh,
and there's a lot of work in this movie.
Oh,
that's,
yeah.
That's 500 extras right there. Used over and over and over again. Those days are pretty interesting as an extra. When you're doing that kind of stuff.
It's interesting how he can always kind of see
through things.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like he can see all the way down there.
But he did it earlier in the film. He's able to focus on something that is of meaning that's going to lead him
here
to
it
the
is
answer.
When you feel the heat coming around the corner.
And he knows.
That's
and,
well
and,
said.
And he sees in there, yeah.
It's getting
and
hot.
Now I'm looking here. I'm like, what am I looking at? Oh, there's the car. Okay, there we go.
You got to be prepared
and
to walk away.
He's prepared to walk away. And notice now this, he spends about 30 seconds, really, mm-hmm. if you time it out. I mean, really. He's thinking it through.
God, right there.
That. Look at that
this
shot.
This is great. This is cinematic. This is just great.
Yeah.
You're right. This really is one of De Niro's best performances.
Look at that.
It's just so understated.
You so feel for, this is like the film that you feel for him the most, I think, than any film.
I don't feel for him. I feel for her.
I feel for her. I mean, in a way, in that
he
moment.
He knew what he was getting into.
No, he knew what he was getting into. No, I was saying, is in that moment, I felt for him.
Hmm. It's interesting. I feel loss. Yes, I understand that, but I feel he deserves it. I feel he gets.
Oh, he totally deserves it.
He deserves much worse, actually. But,
and I like how Pacino just runs by her. He doesn't know who she is.
And she sort of deserves what she gets, too, so I shouldn't feel for her, actually.
And the guy with the shotgun.
Maybe it's the music. I don't know.
The music's nice. You don't like the music?
Mm-hmm. I'm just making a joke. The music is nice.
I like it.
It brings your... It's manipulative. It brings your emotions out.
But it's different manipulative than your usual...
Yeah,
I think there's a different kind of score than you usually hear, and
Michael
I do like
Mann
it.
Michael Mann is what I think.
Nice,
really,
solid chords.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
It's not too busy at all. It was good.
I think it's got a very interesting, different emotional quality to it. This actually reminds me of Body Heat in a way. Somewhat.
Mm-hmm.
The score. Not the
yeah,
movie. Well, there's another noir film.
De Niro's
noir
sucking
film,
off
yeah.
oxygen. And...
Oh, okay. I just kept on thinking, man, they ran for quite a while to do all this
yeah.
stuff. They must have been training for quite a while.
Well, I think I heard something where Pacino is miserable during this because he's not a runner.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's
not in shape.
That's a lot of running.
Smoking
that's
a cigarette over his years.
That's a night of running. Well, all this is like a week of running.
Exactly.
Then the whole downtown sequence.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Well, I mean, and you got to figure at this point they were what, in their late 40s, early 50s?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's great, actually, having an action film with actors that age.
The only thing that bumped me about this movie was this, where I used to work on airports.
Yeah.
And
what is that?
In the early 90s as a contractor. And you just don't stroll onto an airport, even then. It's like you just don't.
Yeah.
Hey, by the way, oh, I'm in the luggage compartment.
I'll agree with that.
Yeah, you're just like all of a sudden you're there. You know, it's like, hey. So even in the
and
early
this reminds
90s
me of Bullet as well. This reminds me of the end
yeah,
of Bullet.
Yeah, but then you don't get the cool
you
shot.
You just don't stroll across
the
plane. Runway.
Come on. It's a great shot.
Hang on. And Bullet was when they... Oh, that's right, because Bullet, they had the thing with the plane, and he's running.
Jim McQueen goes under the plane.
That's right.
You could intercut the two movies and make a whole sequence where both guys are at the same airport.
I like how they duck behind the sound barrier here. It's really cool.
I didn't care for that location.
Well, that being said, I used to work at LAX, and when we were going through our training on the security issues,
mm-hmm.
one guy got on. We had to show our badges every single day as we went on to drive onto the LAX tarmac. And one guy got on for like 8 months straight. He was getting on with a picture of Mickey Mouse that he had just put over his badge, but they had never caught it. So it gives you plausibility whenever you hear stories of, that doesn't seem like it would happen. Yeah, that probably could.
This seems really interesting. I mean, the way he's basically, with everything we've just seen, he's basically set up like the geography. He's like looking and basically scoping out where his hiding places are. And the irony of it all is, of course, is with the whole deal with the airplanes flying over. Of course, he does the whole thing where the lights come on, which ultimately is a downfall. Mm-hmm. In a way, this is kind of Hitchcockian.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this last scene, very much
so. Yeah. It's not Mount Rushmore, but it's Hitchcockian.
Yeah.
Well, it's the airplane lights that do it.
Mm.
Nice lens, and it's all quiet.
Good use of
and
no music,
and no, and barely any sound. And then as the plane comes in and the lights come up, it all comes up together.
I like that they're not yelling ridiculous stuff at each other at this point.
Yeah,
you could have walked away. No, I can't go. I had to do it.
Yeah, but yeah, exactly. They have
it's
no.
In me.
They have no dialogue. There's none.
Again, another sequence of just the camera doing all the work.
Here we go. The lights are coming on, so it's like another thing he hasn't thought of. It's another factor he's got to take into account.
I like this at the end here, too. If you look at De Niro, there's a little bit, he knows he's the hunted. There's a little bit of a trapped animal kind of quality to him.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he knows this is where he's got to make a stand. Because he can't keep on running. Because
Pacino is very much still the predator right here.
Yeah. Cue the music. And what's interesting about that is, that why did Macaulay actually just become the predator? Oh, I like how Pacino on cue comes out.
See, I don't believe that. I think he was waiting for the lights. De Niro was. De Niro's still hunting him right here because he's waiting for the lights to come back up to get him right here. And he knows.
I'm not saying he doesn't
out.
Have a plan, right. But when you look at his face, there's this a kind of look in him.
He's not as in control as
Yeah, he's not as in control as
that's
as,
true.
As, yeah.
Right.
But he knows when these lights come on, he's going to be right in.
Oh, he doesn't think he's out of the game just yet. He's just knowing that he's in a bad position.
Great shot with the plane coming in.
See, he's timing him.
Yeah. And he's going to depend on that, on it blinding him. But.
Shadow.
The shadow. He knows. There it is.
Ooh, he just didn't improvise the shadow. Other than that, it was a perfect plan.
It was a perfect plan.
See that the post sort of predator moment again.
Now, what's your guys' take on the hand holding? You think that's a bit much?
No, I like it because, again, I think it rather than it just being a predator prey moment here. It says it sort of recognizes where Pacino, the predator, says that basically, you know, that they're the same in a lot of ways. That that there's this sort of sympathetic moment. He's not just killing him and walking away. Hmm. There's a sort of recognition of each other here.
Interesting point, but yes, Tim, I think it's a little much.
I think there.
I think it's a good movie moment. Oh, I just don't know if it.
Oh, this. True. Oh, this is all movie moment. I mean, this is all movie. I mean, this is what the movie's all led up to.
After what that guy did to Pacino's life, basically, and.
Well, no, the guy actually he didn't do anything to Pacino's life.
Well, indirectly, but I mean, due to everything De Niro stood for and how he was going about it, and then Pacino's quest to get him, how that wrecked Pacino's life. And you know what I'm saying?
I don't think he would see it that way, that he wrecked Pacino's life.
No. I'd say, if anything, Pacino wrecked. That's the whole thing, is who's the hero? Pacino wrecked, essentially Macaulay's life by coming after him. But he actually didn't. He doesn't blame him, because he knows that he was doing his job. He did what he had to. They had their role. I mean, that's the whole diner scene. You have your role to do. I've got my job. And whoever gets there first gets there. But this is what we have to do. We live in the same world, but I got to do what I got to do.
Yeah, I overstated it by saying wrecked his life, but I just mean as far as the effects it had of being so tunnel-visioned in it, the effects on his marriage, the effects on what, you know.
I think Pacino would miss De Niro after this, because, it was like the supreme hunt for him, and nothing will ever be the same for him after that.
Or could you say it's like Batman Joker, that without Joker, Batman wouldn't exist.
Exactly. It's the same sort of situation once you find that.
Which I feel in this film much more than I ever did in the Batman films the whole first Batman, the Tim Burton Batman, the whole thesis that they're two sides of the same coin, which I didn't think that was necessary. Well, here, I totally get it, that they do need each other.
On my second viewing, I appreciate the movie even more.
It gets better each time.
Sign
of good work. That's
still
great.
Love this film. This film, great.
Actually, seen it this time. This time, actually, there were times when Natalie Portman's character didn't make a whole lot of sense to me in the overall. But now, upon this viewing, she really makes a lot of sense to me in her comparison to Pacino.
Yeah, actually, because before the complaint, I think, when it came out was, well, why is she, is her part seemed a little weaker, and probably that had to do with what was cut out too. Probably a lot of that material was to trim it. I mean, it is what it is. But you're right. I think the whole thing of as part of what his world is, a reflection of his world, works very well.
I think that the city of L.A. needs to be prepared for a lawsuit from De Niro's girlfriend, who will sue him for $30 million for not resuscitating De Niro there at the edge of the airport and allowing him to die.
This is why they call this a movie.
Horrible.
A movie.
That is an atrocity,
Curtis,
that America cannot allow.
Really? Is that all you have to say? Do you have anything else? Do you like this movie?
This is a fantastic film. It's unbelievable. So, what are you going to say? It's a good film.
Still work for you?
Recommend stuff.
I think for the genre, this is one of the better ones I've seen.
Yeah. And it's at 170 minutes. Yeah. And it holds up. I didn't
feel
like...
Because all the character work, that's what really cinched it for me. I cared.
Absolutely.
I cared about the people. I understood the people. I was attached to the people. I cared what happened to them. It was more a character piece than a cops and robbers action picture.
Yeah, well, if it was, wholly plot-driven, you'd be done with it in the first 10 minutes. Have to have the characters in this, otherwise it wouldn't work for the length.
It's all too rare to see in this type of genre to see such good character stuff.
Even care about the Void character.
Oh, Rick, Rick Avery was the armored guard? Oh,
Rick Avery.
He's a big stunt coordinator.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, wow. Okay, now I recognize him. Yep. Okay. Paul Moyer was the anchorman.
Detective number one was Daniel Ohako. I know his brother Jeff Ohako, who's a stuntman for Stallone for years.
Oh, there you go.
Anyhow.
Chapman Cranes. Excellent film.
Thermal camera. That's what gave you your night vision.
There you go. Yep, so it was.
We worked with those guys on Sports Science. Interesting.
Oh, the infrared thermal camera?
Yeah.
Folsom State Prison.
Legal services for prisoners with children.
Wow. Yeah, wow, that's cool. Okay, so here we go, the soundtrack. So it was Brian Eno. I think that's what's at the end, is it? There's a lot of Eno in this. There is. Okay. So maybe it wasn't all Golden Thole. We've been fooled again.
Well, Michael Mann likes to use a lot of already produced music.
Yeah. Could be just, Golden Thole was the orchestral.
Right, alone. So it was a combination of the cues, yeah. Well, whatever. I mean, the music all worked really well.
Yeah, this is a quilt of music that was put together.
That's a lot of music.
Yeah, it is. Look at that.
Yeah, after seeing so many things out of focus, I just wish Michael Mann would use more film.
Kronos Quartet, I am in 1,000% agreement. Absolutely.
I mean, I'm not a digital basher, but at the same time, when you see this, the depth of field, stuff in these.
Doesn't work as, I mean, it doesn't look as good as film. Film looks awesome. So I'm curious as to why, you know, I understand that video can be more flexible, but still, I mean, you can still get what you need with film anyway. So
here we are, 175 minutes.
100.
I liked it.
I liked it too. Yeah, I think it's a goodie. It's a keeper.
It's good to see everyone working, running on all cylinders.
Absolutely.
Each of the talent, you know, and where they were in their career, everyone was running on all cylinders in this thing.
Good stuff. I could dig it.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyone have any final thoughts? I think we've had basically 3 hours to have lots of final thoughts about this. But
well, I mean, the one thing I take away from any time I watch a Michael Mann film is the fact that the secondary characters have a lot more depth than you get out of a lot of, or at least up until this film anyway. Well, the secondary characters had a lot of story behind them that allowed for the rest of the film to play out.
Is this Michael Mann's best film?
I still like The Insider, but it's a personal favorite.
Insider's good, yeah.
I'm not really objective about it. I just really like that film. Yeah, so I go with The Insider, but it's not an objective choice by any means.
Right. I haven't seen that. I should see it.
I saw it. I didn't like it as much as it seems you did. I mean, that was pretty good, but it didn't seem to strike me like this. I don't know what it is about this. But this really strikes me. Well, I want to go back and see Thief, though.
Which
I haven't seen in a long time.
Manhunter's great. But, you know, I think with me, this is an easy choice to be able to say it's his best. But if you really go look at the camera work and the acting of Thief and Manhunter and those old early films he had, they're pretty damn good.
No denying that they're good. Absolutely none. But in terms of, for some reason, me personally, this just stands out as his best from beginning to end. It's basically close to perfect for what it is. And even, you know.
I think, you know, you can make different arguments about different films. I mean, I think for a film that's close to the same length, Last of the Mohicans had a tighter sort of narrative to it.
Yeah, yeah.
In a lot of ways.
Oh, okay. I'm less familiar with that film. Yeah.
But, you know, but I'm just arguing one aspect. If you want to say in the overall, yeah, I think it's hard to beat Heat for sure.
Have you seen both cuts of Last of the Mohicans? There's a director's compared to a theatrical.
I don't know what the last thing I saw was. I've seen it a few times over the years, so I'm not sure what I've seen most recently.
I saw the theatrical, but what's on disc is the director's cut.
Interesting. Okay. I might have to go back and check and see if I've seen the director's cut at this point.
And all I've seen is like the last, I think when you were watching it, Tim, like I saw like the last half or the last quarter of it, so I haven't really seen the whole thing.
Well, no, it's wonderful.
Yeah. I will come back for you. Yeah. I will. Oh, it's very romantic. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Very visual.
Well, extremely cinematic.
I'll have to get out and see that one. Okay. I guess.
Sarah's has already turned off.
I'm not that familiar with it. I mean, from what I saw, it looked really good. I remember, you know.
And it has one thing that Heat is sorely missing, which is Death by Tomahawk. I mean, you just don't get that. And Cannon.
Yeah.
Death by Cannon? Yeah. Okay. Well, and then you have Wes Studi.
And Wes, yeah.
Who always rocks. But he rocked in Dances with Wolves, too, so. Yeah. But then I think, Anyway, anything else?
I think that does it.
I would like to thank Michael for sitting in with us today.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, guys. It's been a pleasure.
Michael, you have acquitted yourself very, very well.
Very good.
We'll have to have you back.
I'm glad to be here.
So
you passed the Wayne Grow litmus test?
Ah. Yeah.
Oh, great, yes.
I'm not Wayne Grow.
You are no. You're no Wayne Grow. You're the other guy, Dennis Haysbert.
Maybe so.
Just drive carefully. And on that note, this has been Serge Dalpierre,
Tim McMillan,
Curtis Nelson,
and
Michael Smith.
And this has been Film Grok. See you next time.